Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is MacBreak Weekly. Air date, December 27th, 2011. The best of 2011. MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak. And by Ford, featuring available Sync with My Ford Touch. Sync with My Ford Touch gets you to your destination with integrated turn-by-turn directions and directional arrows displayed on screen. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at ford.com/technology.
Well, hello there. How are you? Welcome to the Twit Holiday Specials. I'm your host, Father Twitmas. And yeah, today we're going to have some best of MacBreak Weeklies to celebrate the holidays. We gave everybody the week off so that they could be with their family and friends and hookers. And we're just going to show you some of the best moments from the past year, starting with the very beginning of the year. You know what the big story in January 2011 was? The iPhone comes to Verizon. Take a look.
So after you played with it for a while, Andy, did you have any thoughts? I mean, anything? I mean, look, there's a little antenna line different in a different spot, but it must have felt otherwise pretty much the same.
Yeah, exactly. And there's really just no difference between this and the iPhone 4 that most of you guys already have in your pockets.
So don't run out and get one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. If for God's sakes, we all wait. You know, all you people waited 3 years for this. Can you not wait another 5 months to get the iPhone 5, which will almost certainly be available on the Verizon network?
That would be my suggestion, right? Yeah.
Is you're already on it.
If you've got an iPhone 4, stop.
Although I was having some conversations, I think all of us in this conversation have heard from every friend and every relative and every friend of a relative about the rumors and
the
time they could finally do the and something that I've sort of been picking up from this is that a lot of people like to have all the family members' phones on the same carrier and on the same plan. So that might be a really big mover into people switching, people
that's true.
Adopting these. Because there's so many people where, like a husband and wife, they both want to be having the exact same phone. I was talking to a couple last night who was exactly like that. One of them, as a matter of fact, for Christmas got a gift card and was trying to figure out how to use it. And if there's a Verizon iPhone, hey, we all got iPhones for the family. Yay! So there's so many dimensions of this, especially with FaceTime as a way of sort of underscoring that wouldn't it be nice for everybody in this whole family to have not only the network that we've been having for a while, but also to have this new technology.
Does FaceTime matter anymore? I mean, you filed that report via Skype. You can use 3G and Wi-Fi, which you can on FaceTime. You still have the same capabilities, but it's Skype, so everybody can use it. Isn't Skype kind of trump FaceTime?
Not really, because FaceTime is a button on the phone that appears every time you make a phone call. Skype is an application that clever people have to tell you exists and then show you exactly how it works.
So for us, clever people, it's moot.
I wasn't necessarily including myself in that. I will say that this is the first time that I will be sending real love to Skype. You know, that I've said nasty things about them in the past, but the fact that I'm able to do this and be part of this show without having to bring the
pretty
whole
neat
big laptop, which I normally have to do just to do this. This is a 100% iOS business trip, and I have a Skype at least partially to thank for that.
That's pretty awesome, yeah.
I think Apple has missed an important window and is missing an important window with FaceTime as they...
What could they have done to preserve their lead?
They need to make it something that's widely available to developers to be able to incorporate FaceTime into their applications, incorporate it through Skype or whoever else. But anybody who wants to build a video application, it should be easy. It should be a library that they can simply say, and then I want to get a FaceTime call. And boom, I've got access to that. Rather than make it this kind of, I think the test case is going on too long.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that Apple has really missed the boat on. And I don't know how. I think
Tom, do you use FaceTime ever?
No, I'm still on the 3GS.
Oh, Tom, you're like me, still back with Leopard.
Well, we waiting for Verizon.
We can't use all the new. Were you? Will you switch?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So we do have somebody who'll switch.
Sure, I'm ready.
Like February 3rd.
as soon as it's available.
I guess you have to wait till February 10th.
I think so.
Are you under contract?
No, I waited.
I see. So you're an example.
I've been eligible for a new phone for since right. the Force came out.
See, this is what's really interesting is I think there are a lot of people like Tom. I think there is pent-up demand.
Yeah, absolutely.
It should be a better phone because I actually make phone calls.
That's
crazy.
That's why I'm waiting, Tom. I don't know. It should be a better phone if you
I'll
say
you know.
That it's the network, but it may be the hardware. Yeah, will you let me know?
Sure.
Because I'm not buying it until Tom says it's okay. I'm waiting. I'm waiting for you, dude.
I'm waiting, and I'm getting one for Carlita. So we'll have Tom's, we'll have mine. You know,
okay,
well, we can make a phone call between them. So we'll have
crazy.
It at both ends.
They
crazy
can,
they can FaceTime and everything.
I don't believe, and I could be wrong, but I don't believe that the company that would say, let's start spreading out into TVs, a business that we don't know a whole lot about, and there really is no benefit for us to branch into it, but we can say that we're selling a TV set. They're the company that would correctly say, we don't care where you buy your TV from. We want to sell you the box that has the cool electronics in it that makes everything else that we right. sell with an Apple logo on it that much more valuable, and which helps you, you know, increase, turn the tap of money from your pocket into the iTunes store, just turn it all the way to full blast now.
I guess for me, though, I think that the last step, though, is the camera inside. I mean, you know, I just want a 46-inch iMac. I mean, you know, the thing is that it's, or but with just iOS, I don't need it to have anything else. But I feel like, you know, number one is I feel like the Apple TV 2, I'm waiting for them to open up the iOS so that we can actually use applications there. That's the ultimate little net box if they did that.
Yeah. Well, and Jean-Louis points that out. He's saying, well, see what happens there.
That's a $99 net box.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a very interesting.
You know, with iOS. But
I agree with Andy. I think that one of the reasons Apple's done so well, they've stuck to their knitting. I looked at McDonald's, you know, in the old days, they would make everybody else was making, you know, Dairy Queen had 300 menu items. McDonald's said, we do this, this, and this. In fact, it really didn't all start to go to hell in a handbasket until the McRib.
isn't there actually a principle of neuroscience that says that increasing the number of options leads to poorer decisions and longer decisions
right.
rather than better ones?
Yeah, but Apple didn't know anything about phones.
There's actually a hard top limit that if you give someone three options, they can make a good decision. If you give them five options, they'll make it will take them four times as long and they'll make a bad one.
Right.
I think this is one of the reasons. I think they're very aware of that. There's actually a hard number, maybe even somewhere in Apple, that says we cannot make more than X versions of this kind of product.
Too many SKUs.
I just think to me, a TV is just such, it's like the last extension of the tiny iPhone to the iPad to a.
Yeah, but it's a trophy that you don't want to have.
Okay.
I think that if Apple were to, Sony and other companies would be old fashioned enough to say that, well, we're not in the consumer electronics business unless we sell a TV set and a console stereo. Our mommy won't love us and think we're successes unless we're selling a console stereo with a record player.
Right.
And room for records, not realizing that, well, actually, that's it's been years since anybody really used
I'm kind of with Andy on that. But on the other hand, I'm not going to predict because I've never been able to predict what Apple's going to do.
We're taking our old iMacs, the 20, I think 21 or 24 inch iMacs that we've been doing production for MacBreak on.
Those are TVs. I know. I understand.
And so we're putting them on the walls in Twit. In the new studio, we're putting them on the wall to manage schedules.
Right.
You know, and the thing is that what I really want is, you know, an iOS version of that, because I don't really need all the rest of that.
Okay, but I guess here's the real point. Like, the last time I've bought like a new TV, I'm steadily replacing like all the big CRT TVs in my house with LCDs, maybe at a quarter of one a year. I think I replaced the last one this year, and the first one cost me about $600. The second one a year and a half ago cost me something like $400. Last year, a TV that's just as good as the first one I bought cost me $213, and that's what Apple's seriously going to have to compete against, because people are not going to, the people who buy TVs are not looking for, oh, what's my XML RPC?
Yeah, but that's what they said about phones. That's what they say about computers. I mean, that's what Apple does, is they create something,
you know,
that's a premium.
I said the same thing. I said, don't get in the phone business.
Here's a phone. That's a TV. They're real different.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a scalable, comparison.
You've made your points. We have to take a break.
For God's sakes, people buy these things to watch Maury Povich, you know, oh my God, who's my baby dad? This is not the same market as the people who are buying these things.
And that will be the final word.
That's right. I'm broadcasting today from the This Week in Tech party van. If you can guess where I am and come by and say the phrase that pays, well, what do you know? You'll get a free T-shirt or free set of winter gloves that I use to knock the ice off of my car.
Or you're gonna get whatever we have in the laying around in the car. What else do you have there, Andy? What do you have for people here?
Well, let's see. I got Scotch tape, alkaline batteries. Oh. I've got a Beatles tape that my friend John sent me a while back. I don't even have a tape deck, a Papermate marker, or the case that the cassette came in. So all of this, I'm gonna put this back into the prize treasure chest, and I'm locking the prize treasure chest, and that key is only going to be openable by the person who has the phrase that pays. So by all means. I am the Herb Tarlick of internet radio promotion here.
For those of you just tuning in, or for those of you listening, we had some connectivity issues, but we've gotten it working now. And Andy is coming in via Skype on the iPhone, so this is working, and it's looking remarkably stable. What are you using to attach your iPhone?
I can't show you because I have to disconnect it. This is my favorite mount, car mount for anything. This is the RAM mount system. I don't know if you can see that. There you go. This is cool. I'm using my rear view mirror to see the image. This is excellent. this is the RAM mount system that I absolutely swear by.
So does that just have sticky back? Is that like a sticky backing?
Well, this right here is my own little modification. It's just the standard mounting pad with some Velcro on top of it. But the thing is, it's completely modular. So basically, this is component one. The big suction cup that sticks to anything and absolutely will not let go. The rocker arm right there, and then you can basically buy anything you want to stick to the end of it. Ideally, you would probably go and buy a custom, an actual holder that they've developed specifically for the iPhone 4. But I tend to put so many things in and out of this thing that I just prefer to just put a pad of Velcro up there. But this does very much look like the Christmas message from Apollo 8.
And now we've given you by moving the camera around, we've given you some more clues of where Andy might actually be. So possibly later in the show, we'll show you a couple more examples. And the question is, can you find Andy by the end of the show?
Clue number one: you can hear a bell from here, but there's not in a collar.
I have some bad news.
What?
The Mexican Coke is all gone.
The Mexican Coke is all gone.
We have this.
Bring it over.
This is coming to you right
now. Is this made with true cane sugar? No. Can I have a straw for Mr. Anatko?
No, that's fine. If it's not... I'm sorry. If it's
HFC,
so
lucky that top was really on there. That's all I have to say.
Like, as soon as you turned that up, I was expecting...
No.
I didn't need that TV.
In fact, not only was the top on there, but we had a good gas bubble built up. I'm not going to drink out of the bottle. That's rude. And probably somebody else has already done that. Watch this. I just put it behind the TV, and it goes away. Ta-da!
This is me putting my iPhone on
what
a tripod.
Hell? FaceTime.
In case we have to do the rest of this via FaceTime.
I'm prepared.
I think my wife is closer to normal. We got the backup.
Thank God the microphone cut out. There are squirrels out there right now whose faces are like, oh my word, such language.
You know, you just had to scare it. You had to scare Skype with it. So now that phone's up, his connection is going to be great. You just had to.
The Skype lady's hiding underneath her desk right now. She's terrified. She doesn't want anything to do with Andy.
But I'm better now. I'm over it. I'm happy. Happy.
So, and then I love this idea of having an SSD plus a bigger drive for storage. That's what a hybrid drive essentially does. It gives you a boot part that's flash and then a big spinning part that's for capacity. Best of both worlds. So now we're talking about a laptop because of Sandy Bridge that has fast graphics, but maybe a 10-hour battery life, has light peak, so it's very thin.
3G?
No. Don't mess with Dick. No. I think Apple's learned its phone company lesson at this point, don't you?
Oh man, I just find that's like this really like my iPad. Now I know I'm not supposed to be this.
10-second boot time. 10-second. I just want to finish this thought. 10-second boot time. I mean, this is the killer. This is you're exactly right, Andy. Otherwise, there's no pressure to upgrade because we've got fast. I've got an i7. There's lots of memory. There's lots of hard drive. this, you know, there's no pressure to upgrade. Apple has to do something if they're going to get people to buy a new MacBook Pro that makes people go, people like you, Alex, and you, Andy, and me, go,
because we're the only ones left buying them. I mean, because everyone's no, I was saying because everyone's buying the Airs. I mean, the thing is that
everybody had the Air on this cruise. Yeah. It was Air or iPad. There were very few 15s or 17s.
Okay, but that's a disproportionate sample. You're talking about people who are going to South America for a cruise to Argentina.
Okay, you're right.
To Antarctica. They're not going to bring the 17-inch MacBook. That
by the way, never made it to Antarctica. The weather was bad. What a surprise! You know, if I'd really thought about it. So I asked the excursions director, Martin. I said, Martin, how many times has this excursion made it to Antarctica? And he kind of fumfered around. He finally said, none. Zero.
So they put it on
$3,300.
And they think about it.
And you get to the, okay, so I'm all dressed up in a snowsuit. I mean, I was prepared for freezing weather, right? Argentina's 80 degrees and muggy. So I had basically a trunk full of garb that would cover any possibility. I've got ski pants on, hiking boots. I got, you know, waterproof Gore-Tex all over me. I've got silk long underwear, if you forgive the image. And I am loaded for bear. We get to the auditorium. There's 40 of us, including Waz, including, you know, many Mac maniacs, because these are the kind of people who want to go to Antarctica. We get there. They say, we go to the airport. They bring out an actor because we never saw this guy again. And the guide says, this is the best pilot in all of Chile. If this man says we can go, we can go. But if he says we cannot, we cannot. And the guy has a sheaf of papers this thick. And he really looks the part. I think it must be a highly paid actor. And he looks, and he's got the, it's totally an act. He's got the thing. Somebody in the crew had said, I saw the 8 stamp on this. It was like 3 a.m. This guy knows what's going to, he's looking at the papers. I am sorry to report. We will not be going to Antarctica today. So and I got a picture. I put it on Twitter of Waz is in the front. Everybody's like, we're very sad. And we're a little hot. So here's their, and it says in the fine print, and if you can't get to Antarctica, which we've never done, we'll send you to Torres del Pines. So, which is a beautiful national park, and you can only get to by plane. So we had the plane. We were stuck with the plane because you can't cancel a plane at the last minute. You know, the pilot's there.
Just file a new report.
They've paid for the actor pilot. They can't, you know. So the actor pilot now has said his lines. He leaves. We never see him again.
Because he's not a pilot.
I am the best bush pilot in all of Chile. So he leaves. He's done his job. It's probably the same papers every time. And then we get on the plane. They fly us to Torres del Paine and drive us around on a bus for 9 hours in our snowsuits. You know, the only one who's comfortable, you know who's comfortable? Waz. You know why? He's wearing a t-shirt and shorts to go to Antarctica.
I think evidently he had talked to somebody and they'd said, you know, they actually don't ever go to Antarctica.
No, no. Waz says, I run hot. He's like, fine. And Waz says, no, that was great. I loved it. And Janet, his wife, is on the bus. We're all like, and we're jamming this bus and we can't move. It's like, you know, Cartman in our snowsuits. Anyway, but not that I'm bitter.
So I'm bitter about Skype. Leo's bitter about the Antarctica expedition. Alex, what are you bitter about
Alex Lindsay? You know, I actually often show the shows here. I am very bitter. I'm a bitter man. Today, I just can't think of anything that I'm particularly bitter about.
We were a bitter crew back then, weren't we? Hey, how about this? Apple versus Samsung. It was the fight of the year. Watch.
Samsung. In fact, Apple was pretty outspoken. They say they're copying our stuff.
Slavishly copying. That's what they say. Slavishly copying and pervasively copying. At one point, they say the Samsung Galaxy S line might as well be an iPhone.
What?
So they're not holding back with
the endorsement from Apple. They should put that on the
good point. So first, we should say you're standing on this is you are an attorney. Are you practicing now?
No, I haven't practiced for a long time. But I was a copyright attorney.
This was your field.
Yeah, I'm not a patent attorney. I was a copyright attorney, but I have a lot of patent attorney friends. I've been doing these breakdowns for a while. I feel like I know what I'm doing at this
point. And this isn't just a patent lawsuit. There's trademark in it too.
Right. It's actually really really heavyweight. So, you know, if you look at how Apple sued HTC or how they sued Motorola or Nokia, it's a bunch of patents, right? And they're very fundamental, like system level patents, right? This is how the touchscreen works. This is how multi-touch works. All this very wonky technical stuff that normal human beings would, you know, not be able to figure out at first read. This lawsuit is much more, you made your stuff look just like ours, right? And you made it look just like ours, and you did it intentionally so that people would be like, that is just like an Apple product. I'll just buy that instead.
This is, listen to this.
That's the plot of the lawsuit. The
jury trial demand complaint for patent infringement, federal false designation of origin, unfair competition, federal trademark infringement, state unfair competition, common law trademark infringement, and an unjust enrichment.
Yeah.
What's unjust enrichment?
Unjust, you know, it's actually a catch-all at the very end. So if everything else fails...
you got
Apple,
rich!
If everything else fails, Apple can say, well, they took our stuff and made money on it in a way they shouldn't have.
Jiminy.
That'll get wrapped up in a trademark infringement and patent infringement. That's like the last quiver, dying breath of a lawsuit.
Are they asking for an injunction? Do they want to halt sales?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're asking for the whole kit and caboodle. They want them to stop sales. They want to be prevented from ever violating their patents again. And that's up and down Samsung's supply chain and divisions. They want treble damages for patent infringement. They want they want an accounting of Samsung's profits so they can figure out which were improper profits. They want money for corrective advertising. So, you know, the claim is that because they violated the trademarks and the trade dress of the products, that Apple has to do some additional advertising to restore their brand, essentially. And so they want money to restore their brand in that way. I mean, it's a long list of damages. But, you know, the damages at this point, you know, if I was Apple's lawyer, I would list everything I could think of. I want everything I can think of. Because, you know, some of it will get whittled away by the court. Some of it will get whittled, you know, if this ever gets to a jury, which would be years and years from now, some of it get whittled away there. So the list of damages, you know, looks enormous and ridiculous now. But that's really we're going to put everything in the kitchen sink in hopes that we get, you know, 50% of it.
So this is just typical. But now here's something that's not typical. Apple is a big Samsung customer, more than $5 billion worth of Samsung components in 2010.
Yeah, 5.7 billion, actually. It's really, really enormous number. But, you know, the thing about that is Samsung, we think about companies in sort of the American corporate sense, right? So Apple is incorporated in California, and it has Steve Jobs as a CEO and a board of directors, and everything flows down from them. Samsung is, you know, this Korean cable arrangement, which is relatively foreign to us. It's this enormous company that has multiple divisions with multiple division heads who
make bulldozers.
They make bulldozers and sinks. You know, and Samsung Electronics, you know, they have the consumer business and the manufacturing business. There's got to be some relationship between the two. I wanted to touch on this, but, you know, quite frankly, I'm not an expert in Korean business structure. And I didn't want to speculate too heavily on how this might affect Samsung.
So you're saying the components that Apple buys from Samsung, the 4% of their, income.
Right.
He may be a different division, so maybe that division will just say, oh, that's fine. Go ahead and sue those sons of guns over.
As far as I know, Samsung Mobile, when they go out to design a phone, they have to bid on processors just like Apple does. And they have to bid on displays and RAM and all that stuff. So, you know, you see Samsung phones with Tegra processors, with Qualcomm processors in them. Samsung's Windows phone products, Microsoft said you have to use Qualcomm processors, and they went out and did it. There's a bit of a division just because of the structure. And like I'm saying, I didn't want to get too far down this road because I'm not an expert on Korean business organization. But there is a distinct division between the elements of Samsung's business. And I don't think Apple is worried about disturbing their relationship with Samsung Semiconductor because they're in a fight with Samsung. And, you have to think that they've factored into it. But there is also that element of, well, they just sued Samsung. And, you know, I bet these guys have lunch together and they're not happy about it as a company.
Well, look at this is part of the complaint Apple's filing, comparing iPhone to the Galaxy S. Mm-hmm. There's some merit in this. I mean, if you look at them side by side, but all smartphones look like iPhones.
But we can think about this as like a Gucci bag. I mean, Gucci goes after people who basically make bags that look exactly like Gucci. You know, it's the same. The idea is that we've created a certain look, we've created a certain experience that, and if you make one that looks exactly the same, that's counterfeighting. You know, that's the argument that
is this counterfeiting? No, you're not posing as an iPhone.
I mean, going back to these tablets. I mean, once you decide that your design conceit is going to be no buttons, as little decoration as possible, can you possibly now say that you have a design trademark on the idea of simplicity? I mean, yes, these look almost exactly like iPads, but can you really say that the fact that it's a black square of glass without any buttons on it, that that's something that
I think if that's all they did, I don't think that'd be a problem. And I'm not the expert on this panel, but I would say that when you start making the interface look identical to the iPad experience as well, that's when things start to get stickier.
Right. So, I mean, if you look at, you know, there are a million ways to design a phone. I mean, first of all, that you can look at the market, and you can even look at some of Samsung's products, and you can see there are a million ways to design a phone. And if you look at, again, their Apple suits against Motorola or HTC, they didn't do this trade dress stuff. They didn't do this trademark stuff. They focused very deeply on sort of core Android system patents. It's when because if you look at Motorola's Blur or HTC Sense, those interfaces are totally different. If you look at the Droid X, it just doesn't look like an iPhone. If you look at an HTC, what's the new one, the Sensation, just doesn't look like an iPhone.
Well, they all have big panels of glass.
Well, no, but those
they all
are,
have home. Well, I guess
this is sort of a in total kind of equation, right? It's not, you know, I have a panel of glass and you add it up to these icons and it has a, you know, the back is black. That's not how this works. The sort of
so you don't think this challenges Android?
There's a bit of Android. The patent challenges are Android, but the trade dress stuff, the trademark stuff, that's all about when a consumer walks into a Verizon store and the guy says, you know, we don't have the iPhone yet, but this Fascinate from Samsung is basically an iPhone. It looks just like one. It works just like one. Buy this instead, and the consumer's like, yeah, that looks like an iPhone. They walk out the door. That's the problem, right? And that's what Apple's getting at, is you are basically copying our products in order to get people to buy them because what they really want is an iPhone.
What about this image that was just sent to us from our chat room? This is a Samsung F700.
This is everywhere. This has been sent to me like 500 times.
Okay, so this came out, it was released February 2007. The iPhone came out January 2. Clearly, this had to be designed before the iPhone came out. This is the kind of thing they show in court, right?
No.
No.
I mean, yeah. I mean, sure. I mean, this image is like doctored, right? I mean, that wasn't Samsung's advertising for it. And, you know, that hand image.
But the phone's the same.
No, but the phone isn't the same. So if you look at the design patents and what they have, you know, the patents say have specific claims. Let me see if I can put one up here.
Okay.
So
this isn't germane then. This
it's germane in that, yeah, there were other touchscreen phones like this, and Apple's complaint is very histrionic in saying that they completely invented the idea of a phone, right? But that's like Apple, you know. If you look at the design patent or the trade dress, let's see, I'm trying to bring this up here. If you look at the specific trade dress elements that Apple's claiming, which I am trying to find. So you've got rectangular product shape with four corners uniformly rounded, substantial black borders above and below, which you don't have there. I mean, you have the casing, but they're not part of the glass. You have a metallic surround. You have a grid of colorful square icons, which you don't have there. Those are
not colorful. Okay.
Right? I mean, you have four icons in the bottom, the springboard that are application icons that don't change. I mean, this is like the technical nitty-gritty of what they're after. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, this is trade dress. So
right.
A lot of this hinges on what do consumers perceive when they look at this thing, right? Do they think it's an iPhone? And it doesn't matter if it came before or it came after, right? So in court, you would hold this thing up and the ordinary consumer in the market would say, oh, that's an iPhone. Even though it came out, you know, whatever, 6 months before, the action in the marketplace has been such that consumers now associate that product with the iPhone and with Apple. And that's really the crux of it. Right, I mean that's the first thing Apple is arguing is that Samsung is taking our relationship with consumers and they're trading on it by copying the things that indicate to consumers this is an Apple product, this is an iPhone, this is an iPad.
And I have so to say, when image I when, is now, like this image really is interesting. This image that I'm showing right now is from your website. This is mynext.com, that is pretty striking. There is a lot of similarity there.
You know, we say it all the time, and I think what's really telling about this is, you know, there are Android fanboys in this world who are very vehement about Android doing everything right and Google doing everything right. And even amongst them, and even the feedback I've gotten from them has been, yeah, Samsung probably went too far here. TouchWiz
more so than other Android phones?
Yeah, almost completely so. And if you talk to HTC, if you talk to Motorola, they're trying to do something different. They're trying to meaningfully differentiate their products away from Apple, right? If you look at HTC Sense, it is totally different. It's got all these widgets and active wallpapers and, you know, integrates with your social networks. And Motorola does kind of the social networking thing with Blur, and they've got their own widgets. And, you know, they're out there. They are doing something completely different. You know, that's sort of what the patent system is designed to make you do, right? It says, okay, well, Apple did the grid, so now everybody has to try to do something different. And that, you know, in some way, that's supposed to push innovation forward.
Now, Apple did something similar with Microsoft over the recycle bin. This was some time ago.
So that was a long time ago. Yeah. That was the 90s, a long time ago.
And what happened in that suit?
So that was a copyright suit, and Apple's entire strategy there was flawed. I think they learned a lot from it. So Microsoft released Windows 3.1, and they had a license to some parts of the macOS interface, like the original System 6, System 7 interface. And Apple said, well, you had a license to some parts, but you took the whole thing, and we will claim a copyright to the whole thing. You know, the look and feel of macOS. We'll claim a copyright to it. And the court said, well, that's not how copyright works, and you lose. And that took 10 years for the court to figure out.
It took a long time, I remember.
It took a long time. And it was doomed from the start. I don't think, you know, just reading, it just never made any sense. They're not claiming anything like that now. They're claiming, again, it's all about the relationship with the consumer. They're claiming, you know, you're trading on the elements of our interface, our packaging, our hardware, our software, that say to consumers, that signal to consumers, this is an iPhone.
You do a great job of comparing icons in your article. Again, this is mynext.com. The phone.
Yeah, no, this is right from
text.
Apple. Apple
this is Apple stuff. The picture gallery. Even the settings button is a gear.
Yeah, I think the most telling one, it's a gear, right? I think the most telling one is the bottom, the music player.
Yeah.
So in the middle there is the Samsung's TouchWiz music player icon. And on the left is the iOS iTunes icon. And on the right is the sort of desktop Windows and OS 10 iTunes icon. And it's the same. I mean, that's a copy. And there's, I mean, iTunes is like one of the most powerful brands, media brands in the world. And to rip off that icon basically says to consumers, oh, this is music. This is iTunes on my Samsung device. And that's not allowed. I mean, whatever. It's a phone icon. It's green, whatever. When you rip off the icon of the most powerful media company or powerful media brand in the world, which is iTunes, you are really treading on
dangerous. Get ready. Yeah. So it sounds like not only do you think that this suit has merit, but you think that that Apple will be successful.
You know, it's
I know it's unpredictable.
Success is a murky thing to define a lawsuit, right? 70% of cases settle. And, you know, like we've been saying, Apple and Samsung are huge partners in many more ways than they are competitors, right? I mean, Apple can't make the A4 or A5 processor without Samsung's help. I mean, there are vanishingly few other foundries in the world that can do it at that scale and at that cost. So what's success? I think success for Apple is Samsung stops making TouchWiz look exactly like iOS. Samsung starts to be more innovative, right? And that's kind of like success for the consumer as well. I mean, if the end result of this is that Samsung has to go and make TouchWiz better and start making phones that don't look like the iPhone, that's kind of a win, right? I mean, because then the people who want an iPhone can go buy an iPhone, and the people who want something new and different can go buy whatever Samsung makes next. And so we'll see. I mean, you know, there's people hate patents. People on the internet particularly hate the idea of ownership, which I think is very funny. And they hate the idea that Apple can own a messaging icon. And there's a certain aspect of that that's true. I mean, it feels ridiculous. But at the end of the day, you know, they're just using they're availing themselves of the resources of our society, right? Yeah. Which is patent.
This is what you do.
Copyright protection, right? So whatever, they're doing it, and those systems are designed to make companies actually compete. And I think we're all better off if, you know, whatever, if Apple wins or they settle or whatever it is, we're actually all kind of better off if Samsung stops copying Apple and TouchWiz and they start doing their own thing, because that will force Apple to be better the next time.
Let me make the opposite argument, a little bit of the opposite argument, which is that all of these user interfaces and designs and everything are influenced by the other. I mean, this Windows lawsuit, for instance, Windows looks a lot like Macintosh, but that was good for Windows users that there was some consensus about how to do a GUI. You wouldn't want something vastly different. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nele, but it strikes me that the crux of this is Samsung trying to succeed by tricking consumers?
Yes, that is. I mean, you got it. That's the nut, right? I mean, that's fundamentally it. They're saying
they can be inspired by it as long as that's okay.
Right. Well, yeah, right. I mean, that's why the Motorola suit and the HTC suit and the Nokia suit and whatever, all those other Apple Android lawsuits, those are all about very technical underlying system patents, right? How did you make the computer work?
Right.
How are you addressing the RAM? All that stuff. This is about, I mean, that stuff is in here, but it's almost the foundation. The meat of the lawsuit, the front half of the lawsuit, is all about stop pretending to be Apple.
Well,
right?
Maybe this is the wrong audience, but come on. Alex Lindsay, would you accidentally buy a Samsung Galaxy S thinking it was an iPhone?
No, but I could see my parents doing that.
Really?
I could see my parents not knowing the difference between these two.
Oh, honey, it looks just like an iPhone.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see my parents walking into a Verizon store and walking out thinking that they've got something that was just like the iPhone.
I don't think so.
But I
can't imagine even the most technically out-of-touch person.
So many times. Wait, you haven't heard this? The Galaxy S on Verizon. Fascinate, right? Well, before the iPhone came to Verizon, people wanted a Verizon phone. They had Verizon contracts, they're happy with the service, whatever. And they would go into the store and say, is the iPhone out in Verizon yet? And the salesman would say, no, it's not going to be out. Maybe it'll come later. Right now we have the Fascinate, which is designed to be just like the iPhone.
Steve Jobs, the opera.
The problem, exactly, you could do that. Zuckerberg's as
rounded corners. You must have rounded corners. I'm sorry.
This is I almost launched into a song that would have gotten us the explicit tag, but
oh, go ahead.
This is crap. I think you all know that this is crap. You're a jerk. Get your stuff. You are gone. How about you? Defend your system. I don't think you can do what I want the company to do.
And that's the Broadway musical. Vision, that's Steve Jobs, the Broadway vision. Musical.
How come no one shares my vision?
It should be that, too.
I'm writing this down. This is like,
good. I hope somebody's taking notes.
Bills on the floor for someone else to pick up. I'm sorry,
I was going to say, it's obvious you've been working on this for quite a while.
No, you don't know Andy. Really just,
wow.
His best work is just like, boom, right out of the top of his head. That's our iOS tip of the week. And now, it sounds like a hairball when I do that. Our lion tip of the week from Andy and Otko.
In the village, the quiet village, the lion sleeps.
Just give me a weem away.
Sorry,
I was
having fun.
No, I thought you're in the middle of a really good bit. I don't want to see how the bit's like that.
No, that's it. It's downhill from here. Go ahead.
You ever think that in a mall they should just release lions so that if you're going to be wasting time there anyway, you should have to risk your life to get there?
Yeah, make it more exciting.
Louis C.K., ladies and gentlemen, Louis C.K.
I do think lions like to hunt gazelles.
That was a joke.
That was a joke.
I'm afraid I was up very early this morning.
Did you write this in?
I put my stuff. Well, I was.
If you want to get a gazelle, it's key to think ahead of the gazelle. Where will it go? Did you write this? What were you on? How can you let it think it's getting away while it's working towards one of your compatriots? Watch the gazelle for a few days. You'll see the cyclical nature of its roaming. It's not random. Scare it. And it will run that circle quickly. Have a partner waiting on that circle, and nom, 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 lion is happy. What the hell were you smoking,
okay,
Alex Lindsay?
Like, it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was working on the notes, and I noticed that Andy was there, and I was hoping he was going to react. And so I kept
That's
on
really
typing.
Great.
And
you actually gave us instructions for hunting gazelles.
Yeah, exactly. So
That's, there they are. Now watch. That gazelle will go exactly the same way each time. So make sure you've stationed another lion right where he's headed.
See, there they go.
Go, gazelles, go. Oh, no.
Here comes.
There's another lion waiting on the other side. Sorry, gazelles, not this time.
No, I
was just hoping to not embarrass you in front of everybody that you stole that tip from Wayne Gretzky. Okay,
that's right. Go where the puck is headed.
Escape is go where the gazelle is going to be. Don't go where the gazelle is.
That's right. That's the Wayne Gretzky gazelle. And there they are, happy lions enjoying gazelle sandwiches for dinner. Thank goodness they hid the gazelle in the bush. Is that a dog in there? What is that?
Really, Leo?
Looks like there's a German shepherd in with the lions. Get out of there!
There's a little leg sticking out of there.
All right. And now we return from Olduvai Gorge for a tip from Andy Anatko.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this very special Best of Mac Break Weekly. We're going to have more in a moment. But, you know, there are some people we really have to thank for making 2011 a happy, jolly, prosperous year for the Twit family. And number one on the list always, Audible.com. Without Audible, there really wouldn't be this new Twit Brick House and all of the great things we've done this year. Audible, as you know, is an amazing bookstore, audiobooks, 100,000 audiobooks in every category. Lots of good holiday books, too. You know, if you haven't picked out a book for the family to listen to, maybe a New Year's Eve story, you'll find them all at Audible. Thrillers, fiction, nonfiction. There's lots of great tech titles as well. Here's the deal. If you go to Audible, you know what? I have to find the name. There it is. Audible.com/MacBreak. Boy, that was tricky, wasn't it? Couldn't have figured that out. Audible.com/MacBreak. You'll be signing up for the Gold account. That's a book a month, but your first month's free, and your first book's free. You can cancel at any time at absolutely no charge to you, and your book will be yours to keep forever. So that's a pretty good deal. I really think that if you haven't yet tried Audible, you really must. Audible.com/MacBreak. And now we go back to the Best of Mac Break Weekly. What are we doing on this one? There was a kind of a big product announcement this year. We were in Austin for South by Southwest, and Apple released the iPad 2. Let's see that original announcement.
Good morning. Thanks for coming. We've been working on this product for a while, and I just didn't want to miss today. So thank you for having me. And we got something great to announce today. We're going to introduce today iPad 2, the second generation iPad. So what is iPad 2? What have we learned? What can we improve? Well, it is an all-new design. It is not a tweaked design. It's not got marginal improvements. It's a completely new design. And the first thing is, it's dramatically faster. We have a new chip we call A5. Our chip wizards have come up with this, and it's great. It's dual-core processors, right? Two processors inside. And so we get up to twice as fast on CPU performance, but we've really gone all out on the graphics performance. Up to 9 times faster graphics. The graphics on this thing are wonderful. Same low power as A4. We don't want to give up any of that legendary battery life. And even though others are starting to ship, I think this is going to be the first dual-core tablet to ship in volume. So A5 is quite an achievement and is going to give us something that's up to twice as fast on CPU performance, up to 9 times faster on graphics, and the first iPad was no slouch.
All right, Andy, you are thorough. You are a professional, trained journalist. You know how to take something like the new iPad 2, how to hold it in your hands, how to you're not like John C. Dvorak, who looks at the box and reviews it. You actually take it out of the box and review it.
Well, it's that small, it's those little details that will really really set the bar.
He goes the extra mile. He actually
sometimes I even charge it before I try it.
Well, that's actually just crazy
one
talk.
Thing I should point out is that it comes almost fully charged, which is really a nice thing. So you don't, but the other thing I'd like to point out, I got mine. You know, Eileen waited in line at the pop-up store in Austin. They had which was really cool. Only sold iPads. And she brought it to me. I was so excited. It was at the Citrix breakfast, actually. I turned it on, and it said, connect to iTunes. And I thought, oh, I can't use it till I get back to my room. So you still have to connect it to a computer. We are not completely in the post-PC era.
It's still, it's not a paperless office quite yet, no.
I guess the store would activate it if you asked them, but.
I don't know if they do that, because remember that linking to your desktop also gives you backups and also gives you your connection to the iTunes store.
But you couldn't couldn't say to them, look, I don't have a computer and I still want an iPad?
I do not know. I should probably find that out.
That's an interesting.
I don't think my guess would be no, because you certainly wouldn't want the.
I believe they will activate.
They
probably would do something like say, well, dude, you know you're not going to be able to back it up, you know, because you can buy apps directly on the iPad. You can get music on the iPad, but I think they will activate. Yeah, the chat room is saying they will activate it.
Yeah. And also, one of the parts of my sort of insights as I've been playing for the past few days is that Apple has really turned an interesting corner on the iPad in that they weren't complete. I don't think they were completely sure about how people would relate to it after they released it, and they were ready to open up one of three different envelopes after the end of 6 months to decide what path are we going to take with this?
Right.
And they decided they decided to go really gutsy and say, this is not an accessory to another computer. This is a computer in and of itself, and it's a destination computer. We want you to think about doing movies on it. We want you to think about using all your presentations, all your word processing off it. We also want to make sure that no matter what you want to hook it up to and use it with, you'll be able to use it with that. So this is, I think Apple, if you thought that Apple was pretty strong about the iPad in 2010, I think in 2011, you're going to see them being even more aggressive. I think they stopped going after the netbooks, and this year they're going to start going after notebooks with the iPad.
I understandably so. I mean, that was clear in Steve's presentation when he said post-PC era.
Exactly.
He said he basically declared victory. He said,
well, unfortunately, what's that old statement? It's not bragging if it's actually true.
Right.
All the competition got completely papered with this. There's I was trying to twice now. I've tried to figure out how to write pieces about the iPad 2 in which it doesn't sound as though I have totally drunk Apple's Kool-Aid. At least on the iPad's front, there is. I wrote a piece that was published on yesterday, I believe. That was just talking about. Oh, here's the state of tablets. Here's which iPad you might. Here are all the feet. If you're thinking about getting an iPad in about 3 months when there's more to purchase, here's the model to buy. And here's what's coming out from other manufacturers in the next year. And there's just nothing coming out in 2011. That is going to be in any way competitive with the iPad. If you're talking about something that looks like this and fills the exact same role of an iPad, there is nothing on the market that even merits basic consideration.
Isn't that premature to say that? I mean,
no, it isn't. No, it isn't.
You haven't seen the playbook.
I have seen them use the playbook. Also,
why are you laughing? You don't think it's even possible that BlackBerry could compete?
No.
Okay.
Alex thinks it's absurd to even say that.
I think the technical term is preposterous.
Okay, and the Zoom, you have a Zoom, I presume.
Here's the problem: is I've had a bunch of BlackBerry like touchable like screen, you know, screen type phones, and they were so far from usable that it kind of exited my reality.
Okay, Zoom, no.
Let's go back to the playbook. Now, I actually called that one out as if there's any one tablet that's not made by Apple that I'm optimistic or interested or slash optimistic about, it is the playbook, because it's the one tablet coming out in 2011 where it's clear that they're not trying to make an iPad. They're trying to make something different. I think one of the smartest things that BlackBerry did was listen very, very carefully when Steve Jobs railed about, oh, 7-inch tablets are stupid. There's no way it can possibly work. They're going to die. And at BlackBerry, they said, okay, so Apple is definitely not going to make a 7-inch 7-inch tablet. Let's make ourselves a really good 7-inch notebook tablet. And I only had about a half hour of time with a working playbook so far, but I like what I saw.
I thought it was quite impressive. It multitasked beautifully. Where they're going to have problems is what Steve Jobs pointed out already with Honeycomb, is that there is the app ecosystem. I mean,
it's not Honeycomb. They're doing.
No, I know it's not Honeycomb. It's Qnix. But I'm saying that that's the same. You know, Steve said there's only 35 apps or whatever. He said 10 apps for Honeycomb. It's even worse for BlackBerry.
They said 100, but here's the difference. I'm not convinced that you need to have a million apps available for a million apps to make it work. I do think that if you have a decent tablet that fits a certain role, that works well, and is priced right, if you have the right 10 apps for it, including the Kindle app, and Amazon will build a Kindle app for it. If you come out with a new wristwatch and you ask Kindle, Amazon to please make a Kindle app for it, they'll make you a wristwatch-based version of the Kindle app. A good office suite, good web browser, make sure the email is good enough that you can rely on it all day long.
Well, that's a question mark with the playbook because it doesn't come with an email app, which is very strange.
We'll find that out. Unfortunately, as with all of these tablets, the biggest damage is that they're not willing to tell us in advance how much these things cost.
Yeah. That's because they can't get anywhere near their price.
That's the issue. They couldn't do it. The Zoom, they couldn't do it, right? It is a faster system.
Well, now they're
better components, Zoom? Right?
But the tests are with the iPhone.
Yeah, it's not faster. Yeah,
the iPad or the Zoom.
We're talking about the Zoom iPad being 2. More expensive than the iPad 2
okay.
because it has higher quality components.
But it's not as fast as the iPad 2.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
What components are better?
Camera?
I spent
The playbook camera is definitely better. We know that.
Okay. I did spend Sunday doing side-by-side photo shootouts, and I don't think... It reinforces the idea that the iPad 2 camera is kind of awful, but I compared it against the Zoom camera, against the Samsung Galaxy Tab camera. They're all really designed for video and not for still pictures, so you're not going to get a good camera in a tablet right now.
Yeah, actually, Macworld, I think, did a side-by-side comparison also of the pictures. Galaxy Tab, iPad 2, Motorola Zoom. They agreed with you that unfortunately, that the camera, the still camera in the iPad wasn't so good.
But
the Zoom wasn't as good as the iPad 4. They didn't have a BlackBerry, of course, to test. So I think it's premature to say there won't be anything in 2011 that's as good. I don't know how you can say that, Andy.
There are five different manufacturers who have announced an intention to enter into this market. I have now seen all five of their pieces of hardware. None of them have been able to add an innovation that can exceed the iPad 2 in 2011. There is no feature that they have in their device that the iPad does not have. They will not be able to get anywhere near the depth and the quality of the apps that are there. Also, none of these devices I have seen have anything close, as integrated and as coherent as the experience you have on the iPad. Android 3.0, it's a big leap forward. And when I reviewed the Zoom a few weeks ago, I did say that it's the first tablet I've seen that's actually in the iPad's class. If you want to use if you need something that does the job of an iPad, the Zoom can do it. It just won't do it quite as well. But you still have an incredibly clumsy and inconsistent experience from app to app to app. That's why I think that 2012 will be very interesting because each one of these companies that's competing with the iPad will have extra components in place. HP, for instance, has announced that they're really going all in on WebOS. It's going to be their phone OS. It's going to be their tablet OS.
Yeah,
and WebOS will also ship on all their desktops. And
I thought that was quite interesting. So WebOS really is going to be an interesting player as well.
Right. So that's an example of don't try to make another iPad. Right. Try to make your own thing. So many people, there's so many great reasons to buy an HP desktop or an HP notebook anyway. So you need to buy yourself a brand new i21 81 core processor upgrade to your notebook in 2012. Late 2012, early 2013, now you're finally in a mindset where you really want to buy a 10-inch tablet. You've got the iPad, which is wonderful. Then you've got this HP tablet, which will act as a completely transparent... I'm speculating here. Please realize I'm speculating. But now you have, on the other hand, you have this other tablet that is designed to be absolutely intimately related to everything that you do on your HP, where it will automatically find your HP computer, no matter where it is, run the exact same apps in the exact same way with the exact same data. This will just be a projected version of everything you've got on your desktop. That suddenly makes it an interesting buying decision when you've got these two tablets side by side. But that's not going to happen until 2012. In 2011, I don't see any competition. And of course, I did realize how far I was sticking my neck out by saying something that dramatic. And believe me, that's one of those things where I type something and I keep looking at it and I focus on it every time I look at that draft. But in the end, if I truly believe that and I truly believe I can defend that, I have to say it. So if there's something else in November, the first line will be, I was wrong, I was wrong, I was wrong, I was wrong. The new Lombada Wear Disco Pad 21 2012 is the most awesome thing ever. Okay. I've just thrown away my idea.
So let's then maybe qualify what you said. In my crystal ball, from what I can see so far, there's nothing even on the horizon that's.
But don't we? CES is usually where people are blowing their wad. I mean, that's when they're showing us that what this is what we're going to do this year.
When we didn't see anything at CES. No, I agree with you on that.
You know, and they wouldn't let me touch the Zoom.
Yeah,
I mean,
we've touched the Zoom now,
and I mean, we have now. But I'm saying, but that's like it was so early on.
Samsung's doing a 10-inch with Honeycomb. I liked the Galaxy Tab a lot. I would say it was close. I would consider it perhaps closer to the iPad 2 than you did, Andy, but I agree with you that there's nothing in the class of iPad 2, even the Galaxy Tab, which I think is a very good product.
I still feel like this is like the iPod version 2, where you know everyone's scrambling. The iPod made this huge impact, right. And then everyone scrambled, and then it got too far ahead, and then everyone just kind of gave up, moved on.
Well, Apple didn't advance. Now, this would be my thumbnail review to interrupt yours briefly, and then we'll get back to Andy. Apple didn't advance the game that far. They kind of advanced them minimally far. It's thinner. It's a little lighter. It's got a camera, not a great camera. It's faster, but until we see apps that take advantage of it, it's not particularly noticeably faster.
Oh, it is way faster.
In every app, I don't see that. Most apps are single threaded, so I don't think I would expect that.
No, it doesn't. It's so hard to find a benchmark that's real world. What my benchmark was actually the best solution that I could come up with was Auto Stitch. And I decided that I'm going to, because it's an iPhone app. You can see that I'm running it actually just in, it's an iPhone app.
Right.
Where I took a 23-shot panorama.
That's big.
And decided that I'm going to calculate how long it takes for the iPad 2 to build that panorama and how long it takes for the iPad
1. That's a fair comparison.
And the iPad 2 got it 2.2 times faster than the original. Everything works faster. Now, you're right in that a lot of different applications are going to be tuned for it. I have a list right now that Apple provided me of apps that they know for a fact have been optimized specifically for the iPad 2. The biggest games are they didn't even as far as I know so far, and I'm still trying to talk to the actual developers of these games. They haven't actually made processor specific enhancements. They've simply said there is so much better performance in this chip that all we have that you know how we decided that we're not going to have this really really higher density texture map for the crowd scenes and the glints off the armor and the weapons because the iPad 1 processor couldn't handle it. Let's just upgrade all of those textures because now we know that the graphics processor and the CPU can definitely handle it. That's why you don't necessarily see, or in my experience, you don't necessarily see greater frame rates, but you do see that every single object is greater detailed because, and not because they optimized it for the processor, but because they simply replaced the game elements with ones that would take a lot more time to render properly.
The two places that I noticed it the most was in GarageBand and also in the Daily. You know, the Rupert Murdoch's. You know,
oh,
Daily.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, the Daily. The Daily was.
You're
like,
actually still reading that?
Yeah,
it's pretty awful. you still have the free subscription. What? I hope you're not.
No,
paying
I'm playing
for
with it.
You
know,
are. You're paying for
I have,
that.
I have friends that work there.
It's wonderful. Then I just love it.
You know, they have, but they. My brother shot. They did a thing on Rango, and my brother actually shot the interviews. I mean, he shot the video for.
Oh,
us,
all right. Well, I like them. I
see,
think the Daily is keeping
great
people like your brother. Painfully employed, I
exactly.
Like
so the but it was when it came out, it was really clunky. You know, on the iPad 1, you know, like the when you start moving stuff, everything doesn't really want to move very well, and everything else. And on the iPad 2, suddenly it was like boom, it really made a difference. The other one though is GarageBand, where on the iPad 1, it's constantly re-optimizing, and on the iPad 2, it's just. Fluid.
They never really wanted you to run Garage. I mean, you can run GarageBand on the iPad 1, but it was clearly positioned for the iPad 2.
Yeah. My son still enjoys it on the iPad 1, but...
Is it multi-instruments that have a hard time?
It's actually any individual instrument seems to work fine. It's when you add... it's when you start layering them that they start to react.
Tracks.
Yeah, when you start adding multiple tracks, it starts to get ugly.
I have to say, this... I could see how this would really challenge the GPU and the processor and what it's doing.
You played
and
with
all
the smart keyboard, right?
Small keyboard. I mean, it's just the smart instruments are really what's most interesting to play with. This is a spectacular program.
Yeah.
This by itself should sell a lot of iPad 2s.
Yeah. I showed that to my wife, and she literally within like a minute of looking at GarageBand, she was like, I need one.
Done.
I need one. When do I get one? I said, well, they're now. I should have bought two. What was I thinking? That's all I got to say. Now I have to wait weeks with her stealing my iPad.
So what else, Andy? Give us some more of your thumbnail review.
It's hard to really appreciate exactly how much thinner this actually is compared to the previous one. I have to make a certain point kind of delicately. I want to do a personal note to Apple. I love it that it's that much thinner. It's incredible that this is actually a multi-core, really, really incredibly powerful computer. Please don't make it any thinner than this. I think that they found exactly how thin they can make this without making it a little bit harder to use. I kind of wished before, I started using it without the cover attached, and I kind of wished that the back were a little bit grippier, because when it's this thin, there's no hard edge of any kind to sort of settle into a crook. I could sort of sense myself being stupid at some point, trying to put this like inside my bag and my finger slipping on it and actually dropping it. But balanced against that is this cover is you cannot. It's I have to sort of reel back a lot of my enthusiasm about certain things without looking like a stupid Apple fanboy. But this cover, only Apple I think could put this much thought into something as simple as a protective cover. Because you've probably seen how it has this cool thing where it automatically wake itself and sleep itself. Look how fast it does that. That's how fast. You don't have to wait. You don't have to unlock it or anything. You open it, and it's as though it was never asleep to begin with. You've seen the other two modes where you can set it up as a typing easel or as a stand easel. But then as I'm sort of like playing with this and I'm thinking, dang it, it's kind of hard to hold it and read, I realize that you can accordion fold it. And this is the most comfortable thing in the world to hold on to and read with. I was at a diner, having breakfast at a diner this morning, holding it like a newspaper while I'm having my pancakes. And it's the most comfortable thing in the world to hold on to. It feels, you feel as though, yes, this thing cost me $500, but man, did Apple really want to earn every penny of my money in this design? iFixit did a teardown, of course, not only of the iPad,
they,
but also
they tore down the cover. Right.
But
I love again, iFixit.
You think what's the easiest thing you could possibly do? Well, of course, the slick thing we're going to do is we're going to put a magnet in it. But it's designed so that it's almost you have to work to get this to go on the wrong way.
Frosty sat on the mute button, I think. Meanwhile,
back at the ranch.
Did you put your mute button?
Oh, Lord. So,
sit down.
Oh, he does that trick. It's really cool. If you could see it, unfortunately, just off camera where he lifts the biscuit off his nose.
He'll sit there with it balanced on his nose until I tell him.
For hours.
He's such a good boy.
And then you say, okay, and he just goes... Snarfs it right up. Such a well-trained...
Buster,
is that his name? It keeps changing.
Hmm? His job title is Distracto the Wonder Dog.
Oh, Distracto the Wonder Dog.
At least that's how I claim him when I use his salary to, you know, siphon to hide some of the money that I've been making off of the poker sites.
So there was this company named Lanza. My name is Ryan Brown. I work for Lanza Healing Hair Care. Listening to your last Mac break, I heard you were talking a lot about John Gruber's hair. So now everyone in the Twit Cottage can have great hair.
No, that's not really possible.
They've sent me.
Nice of them to say, but
they've sent me. Wow, I mean, a lot of hair care product from Lanza. I've never heard of them, but now I will be in ever. Oh, look, here's a hair mask.
Do they have the clarifying gel?
I'm going to put this on right now. We're going to see. Let me see what it says. It says, use twice weekly as often as needed. Apply to damp or dry hair. Leave in for 5 minutes. 30 minutes for seriously dehydrated hair. Well, mine's very dehydrated. Let me just put some of that in there. And this is going to really help the show. Yeah, look at that. All right.
All right.
Thank you, Lanza. It is a little Pee Wee Herman, isn't it?
Little eraser head.
Yeah. Lyle, love it.
Unfortunately, I can't really contribute to this section, can I? So
yeah, Don, you're kind of left out, aren't you?
Yeah, well, you know.
You want some hair care products? I don't think. Wait, let me see if they have anything that grows hair.
Oh,
How about this?
Given how successful last week was, I think it's time to go for the. I'm sure there's somebody who does like mustache wax, you know, stabilizers, combs, beard trimmers.
Let's go
like
for it. You know, maybe Lanza does.
And the mustache. I think
look at Adam's hair looks good. You've been obviously taking good care of your hair.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm going to send you, Don. We're going to put this
podcast ever, I must say.
When you come, Don, when you come out next week, I'll give you this. This is Lanza's healing style.
Okay.
This will heal your.
How's that stuff taste?
It smell. What? It smells good, doesn't it? Don't I smell good? Oh, dear. It's starting to stiffen. Healing volume. This is like Christmas. Anyway,
and so this clip will be the answer to the question from every watcher of every podcast you do this week. Why was your hair look so funny that on that podcast this week's? Well, because I did Mac Break Weekly just before it, and I got this impulse.
Oh, you're right. I have another show to do. Oh well.
Can you do a Christopher Walken impression? If you learn to do one before your next show,
this would be good. This would be the time to do it. Well, thank you.
Very concerned. Wow.
I got a lot. Thank you to Ryan Brown in Lanza Marketing. By the way, his email address is at me.com.
You know, I still haven't got that stuff out of my hair. That's why I'm wearing this hat. So we continue with our Best of Mac Break Weekly. Hope you're enjoying our post-Christmas kind of holiday. I ate too much turkey and now I have to rest week. We're going to be back in just a moment with more. But first, I want to remind you that this show, as always, brought to you by our friends at Ford Motor Cars. CES is coming up in a couple of weeks. We're going to do our live coverage from CES. Ford will be there. In fact, I'm very excited. I'm going to get to have dinner with the CEO of Ford, Alan Mulally. And if you've got any thoughts you'd like me to pass along to Alan, I want you to email me, leo@twit.tv. I'll be asking him questions. I'll be talking about the cars, my experiences with the amazing Ford Sync and my Ford Touch, things we could do better, things I'd like to see him work on for future. You know, I love the app link. We've seen that, the ability to tie the smartphone to the sync. But the feature that I recently tried out that I was very intrigued by, I took a ride in a brand new 2012 Ford Focus, and we tested out the sync services. Actually, watch this video. Hey, Leo Laporte, Brick Twit House, and once again, I want to show you the cool stuff Ford is doing in their new vehicles. This is the 2012 Ford Fiesta. Very affordable car with great features, including the Ford Sync. I want to show you how Sync now can use mobile apps on your phone, like Pandora, Stitcher to listen to iPods, Pandora to listen to music, OpenBeak to listen to tweets, and they just added Slacker Radio, too. It's pretty amazing. First, let's get in the car. Almost everything you do with this Ford Sync, you do with your voice. Yeah, I kind of like that. So here's the Ford Sync button here on the turn signal. Let's turn the car on and I'll show you how it works. Let's have Pandora running. I'm going to connect this to the USB connector. Notice USB connector right here. I'm using the standard iPhone cable. That's great because it's also charging the phone while I'm listening to it. I can just keep it here, make phone calls. And I do it all with my hands on the wheel, my eyes on the road. Just press this button.
Mobile apps, please say a command.
Pandora. So now my Pandora is connected, and I can listen to a station. Let's say I'll play a station, Lady Gaga. How about that?
Pandora, please say a command.
Play station Lady Gaga. So now I'm listening to Lady Gaga. This is great because it means as I'm driving along, I can listen to songs that I love from artists that I love. I can even create new stations. If I don't like a song that's playing, I can thumbs down it. If I like it, I can thumbs up. In fact, let's do a thumbs up right now.
Pandora, please say a command.
Thumbs up. Thumbed up. How about skip?
Pandora, please say a command.
Skip. All right, now we're rocking. This is all streaming in via 3G. So I could be just driving down the road listening to great radio. If I want more information about a song or I want to buy a song, I can tell it. I can create new stations. So the beauty of this is I don't have to
take my eyes off the road. I know it's on the display there, but I don't have to. I can just drive along and I can say, well, what was that song? And it will tell me. I just love that. So you can see how easy it is. You can listen to podcasts using Stitcher. You can listen to music using Pandora. You can even have your tweets read to you with OpenBeak. That's the sync with the new app link. More and more apps all the time, which means more capabilities from Ford Sync. And you don't have to do anything. As long as you got the apps on your phone, that's all you need. Pretty cool. Drive one today at a Ford dealer near you. I hope you get a chance to drive a Ford sometime soon at a Ford dealer near you. Really, truly great stuff. Now, another big boy, Apple had a really big year in 2011. There was a lot of news, including the new version of OS X. Our first look at Lion next.
We've had Lion now for a week. How are we feeling about Lion?
So far, other than a couple things not working, I think it's been working well. I have to admit, I only put it on my small laptop, and it's in a dual boot because I'm just still. I tend to do these things very slowly.
Yeah.
So for the show, I've been doing it, but it's only been like, oh, I got to do some homework. And look at it, because most of all our production computers were taking a little bit more time because right. There's been a lot of production programs that are breaking.
A surprisingly large number of incompatible apps I'm seeing.
There's a lot of incompatible apps. And so you people just need to remember, a lot of people have been going, oh, I installed Lion and nothing worked. And you're kind of like, okay, well, you need to watch and make sure that your app is ready to go, especially if you have more expensive apps that take a little longer, especially production apps. On the Mac, you need to take a little time and just slowly move into that. We have one iMac in the back that has Lion that we're kind of starting to test.
I put it on everything. How about you, Andy? What is your take so far?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that you have it on the iMac. I have come to realize that I was at a disadvantage because I had the developer edition, and it was only on an iMac that I don't use for anything else. So that had two different effects because I'm working on a few books and I can't have it on my main MacBook. So that was the other situation. But I find that it makes a lot more sense to me now that it is on a smaller screen, something with an integrated touchpad, than it did on a big iMac with a keyboard over here and the touchpad over there. So I find myself using gestures a lot more. I find myself using spaces a lot more than I did before. And also the flip side of that, though, is that it also means that things that were only when I was just testing it out a couple hours a day and writing my review, that were just, that's kind of weird that it works that way. Now that I'm using it 10 hours a day for a week, are now, oh, for the love of holy pogo stipping, whatever.
For the love of or a bad for the love of?
For the love of the explicit tag, yeah. I mean,
Is that a happy Andy?
I'm sorry you were breaking up there.
Is that a happy Andy?
I love Lion. I think it's great. I think it's a critical upgrade. I think that everybody should, after they've made absolutely sure that they're not going to be locked out of their favorite apps, I think that everyone should upgrade to it. But it's only underscored my impression that like the invisible scroll bar thing is just, it's not just simply a redesign. It's a mistake. It's a full-on mistake. It's a stupid mistake. I've been taking screen captures of every time, especially when I'm on the web, I'll find a circumstance under which something simply doesn't work. Because like a frame a panel inside, like for instance Google Reader, thinks that it has the entire width of the frame, so we'll put like a little pop up, a little menu dingus button at the extreme right of that column, which is great because that still works just fine. But now if you expect to have a scroll bar there, you will move the mouse pointer to reveal the scroll bar. You want to grab that handle to scroll all the way up or right down to where you want to go. But as soon as you click down, Google Reader gets the click instead of the scroll bar,
right?
And so many other apps where it looks so there's like a box or window that looks so pretty and so well designed that I think, okay, well, I'm seeing everything that's inside this window. Nope. It just happens that the bottom of the box or the bottom of the window happens to be a natural division between one section of content and the other. Yeah. You have no idea that there's actually four more pages worth of stuff to scroll through.
That is a loss because this scroll bar used to give you information.
And yes, you can always switch that back. And yes, I can. I've got two separate issues here. You know that I don't like the idea that they reverse the direction of scrolling.
Right.
But I can at least dismiss that as saying, well, you know what? It was arbitrary to begin with. After a few weeks, I'm going to get used to it. I still don't think it's a good idea, but I'll get used to it. This idea of invisible scroll bars, absolutely, flat out, bad, stupid idea that I have to guess was the subject of long arguments that they just simply said, we got to ship. It's a stupid idea, period. Mm.
You agree, Alex?
I haven't gotten used to it either. I think Andy said it all. I don't like. I like. I like the scroll bar. I'm attached to it. I don't like the reverse. I don't like the. I mean,
in its defense,
I'm still in this, you know,
in its defense,
it looks nice. It looks.
It
pretty.
Takes up less space, so we have more content.
We have pretty big screens as it is. I don't feel like I'm running out of content. A lot.
I know. I'm working hard here.
you're working at it.
In its defense,
you're trying to rebuild your Apple cred.
Yeah.
Here's the funny thing. I like Lion. I haven't had any problems. I got used to the fact that the scroll is reversed, and I don't even think about it anymore. I do like some things, like, for instance, this, where you launch Mission Control with a three-finger up motion. I like being able to go from full screen to full screen using – I stopped using Spaces almost immediately, and now automatically I'm using it all the time. I think I'm starting to like it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And I've lived with the scroll bar thing. I think I maybe just don't have the habit that you guys did of using the scroll bar directly. Because that's where that's the biggest loss, right, is that you can't just it's harder to click on it.
Well, not only does it make it harder to click on, but there are many instances in which it's things now do not work because of this design conceit.
Okay.
It happens a lot in the web, but it also happens more often than you would think in real apps, where if it makes something stop working, bad idea. Or rather, you have to have an exceptionally good reason for doing it. And when you say that, we need all that extra real estate on our 2,000 pixel by 1,500 pixel display. I mean, goodness, that would be a whole extra six dots that are going to waste.
Right.
Like, yeah, again, it makes perfect sense on an iPhone screen. Does not make any sense whatsoever, even on a MacBook Air screen.
I absolutely
agree with you on Spaces. Again, when I move to a machine with a smaller screen, that's when Spaces really comes into play. It doesn't feel natural when you've got a big screen. But
all of this stuff seems good on the Air, is better maybe on the Air than it is on the 27-inch screen.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's the case. And I think they expect to sell a lot of 11-inch Airs. So they're kind of building an OS for the Airs and for the iPads, right? 1 million copies sold on the first day.
It's a good start.
How about the upgrade process? Has that been pretty painless? I mean, I actually haven't done a clean install yet. I've done nothing but an upgrade in place. I did make a USB key right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this last week, but a reminder, you can't make the USB key once you install Lion. It deletes the installer. So you have to get the installer out.
I think Don McAllister did a great little tutorial on that as well.
He has a screencast?
He has a screencast.
Screencast
on that,
online.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think the install went surprisingly smoothly, and the fact that a million people now have downloaded this and presumably installed it, and I haven't heard a single howl of pain. Any upgrade issues that I've heard? Anybody's heard of?
I didn't do a clean install even after I said I would.
I know, I didn't either.
I was just like, oh, I just want to see it. And so I just put it on, and
it works.
Working fine, yeah.
There are a few simple issues. There's some permissions issues that often happen when you do a regular upgrade. There are also some permissions issues that have to do with the fact that now the OS interacts with files in a different way. So things that you'll want to do something to an app that you could have done lickety split in Snow Leopard. Now we'll tell you, I'm sorry, you don't have permission to do that.
I have to admit, I'm not crazy about the new Finder conceit of all my docs. I want to see the computer, and you have to go back into settings so that you could see the computer. Otherwise, there's really no way from Finder to get to your computer's contents, which is...
I'm not sure if I agree. That's more of a style thing that gave me a little bit of a blip, but I understand the logic they're going to. They moved... when I have an attached USB device like a memory card, I'm expecting it to be in a certain place. Now it's actually in a different place.
I don't see it under favorites. Is it hidden somewhere that I'm missing?
I'm sorry?
I don't see it under favorites. Is it under devices? I can't see... In other words, I can't see my hard drive. I want to see my hard drive.
Okay. Right. Well, okay, yeah. That is a level of abstraction they decided to do away with, which I actually think... which I actually think is a good thing.
It's not that abstract. It's my hard drive.
We're old folks. I mean, we want to know...
Really? You think that's weird?
I think part of this
I want to go to the system library file. I defy you in the default behavior of the Finder to find... I could find the Leo... Well, now it's crap. I could find... Now I don't know what's happened. It's broken. Because you frequently... Don't you? Maybe I'm only the one who... Actually, I've corrupted my Finder. Let me reopen it. Maybe I'm the only one who does this, but system library... So you get there from the root. How do I get to root directory here? I can get to Leo.
Well, if you go to Macintosh hard drive, don't you see that?
And there's no more, by the way, as far as I could tell, library folder.
But weren't you just at Macintosh?
In the home
folder. Didn't we see the Macintosh hard drive?
Yeah, because I had changed the when you open a new one, I changed that.
You go under Finder Preferences and you'll find it.
I did. I changed the preferences. But, but by default, there's no way to go from Leo, my home folder, up a level.
But that's kind of okay because... there's something that was told to me back when the transition from Mac OS to a core of Unix went. An Apple engineer told me that if our philosophy about the Unix switchover is that if you don't want to see the Unix and you see it, you failed. If you want to see it but you can't find it, then we've also failed.
It's not that hard. I mean, you go to the Go menu, you can find it.
People who have that sort of sophistication, who want access to the root library folder, they can pretty easily find it. But it's not going to confuse people who are going to like maybe save a file someplace outside of their home directory, which they can do, and then they can't find it again because they don't. It's not in their documents folder or elsewhere.
The default behavior is you're in your home directory.
And I think the default behavior also is if you're not geeky. I mean, like the idea is that many people never need to see their system folder, and so the idea is to keep them out of it. Like,
don't go there.
As a father of a 3.5
that's
year old,
a good
that
point.
Finds parts of my TV interface that I didn't even know existed.
That's a good
and
point.
Everything else, I'm kind of glad that the system folder is no longer available because every time my kids open up my iPhone, I've got different desktop images and different pieces, and they've changed a bunch of settings. And so, I mean, I think that if you're talking about a school or a corporation or whatever.
No, you're
by
right.
By default, and hiding all of that stuff just keeps people out of trouble.
It's exactly what Andy said, which is if you're smart enough to want to use the full system, there's ways to get to it, but it's just not by default. It's hidden.
Right. I also think it's a good trend to try to, what I was saying before about abstracting the file system, where it's no longer really important that I have a certain file that's inside a pictures folder, inside my user directory, inside my documents folder, so long as whenever I need this file, the operating system can help me find it. So I think it's kind of cool that we now have at least an alternate view of on my Mac that simply says, I know that at some point I wrote this outline. I don't know where it is. I'm reviewing the Nook tablet this week in the Sun Times, and I looked at the draft that I finished last night, and I'm saying I got to cut this part down, the part where I spend 1,000 words basically yelling at everybody who said, oh, it's sluggish, the page turns don't look like raised curved paper anymore.
Who cares?
I launched an app and it took 3 seconds and oh, this is a piece of, oh, what a humiliating embarrassment for God's sakes, you got a tablet that cost $199 that streams a million different things, and you know what, if I had an extra $300, yes, I would buy an iPad. Maybe I don't have an extra $300, and maybe I don't have a pocket that can hold a thing that's shit.
So am I wrong, Andy? Am I wrong in thinking that this is all about people's attitude toward, it's where they're coming from, right? If you're coming up from like a Kindle, an e-ink Kindle, you're going to have a totally different expectation than if you're coming down from an iPad.
Not only that, I think that when I see not all the like complaining reviews, but some, but a lot of them, I'm really taken back to those halcyon days of April in 2010. If those of you who can think back that far, and you see all these really negative reviews of the iPad, who said, "Oh, I can't believe they built a netbook without a keyboard. It doesn't have even one USB port, let alone three."
Right.
Like, okay, you're an idiot. They didn't decide. What Apple did was they decided not to build a netbook, but to take all the things that attract them to netbooks, small, large batteries. A huge battery life, inexpensive, does a certain core group of things extremely well, and they articulated it in the form of the iPad. I really think that the Kindle Fire is that exact same thing, only applied to the iPad. They didn't try to make an iPad. They simply said, what is it that people really like about the iPad, and how can we make this into a product that makes sense for us, Amazon? And you start off with 199, not 200, right. 199.
Never stop. I'll climb this stinking ladder till I make it to the top. The blushing bride, she looks divine. The bridegroom, he is doing fine. I'd rather have his job than mine when I'm cleaning windows.
That was a lovely music hall song.
Also, it got a ban from the BBC in like 1934.
Yeah, because of the blushing bride line.
I'd rather have his job than mine. There's also the line where it's... funny, the things that go inside when I'm cleaning windows, yes.
Oh, I didn't hear that part.
It's a later. There was a spotted talking movie queen. She looks more certain. Then the scene, she looks more like 60 than 16 when I'm cleaning windows.
See what good things we put your money to when you buy a Twitbrick. Yes, Twitbricks make it possible for Andy and Notko to play the ukulele. Twitbricks bring us things like Andy's hat. Twitbricks make all good things possible. So please, give generously to Twitbrickdom. Thank you. And now Andy and Notko will play a song for us all.
I'm caught in a trap. I can't walk out. Because I love it too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me? When you don't believe a word I say, we can't go on. We can't go on together. Ah, I can't do the chords and the sing at the same time.
I know it's hard.
Together with suspicious mind.
Not as good as Andy, however.
Actually, I think I only know like the first couple things of lyrics.
That was just fun.
It's hard to justify upgrading from the 4 to the 4S, although the 4S is a lot more significant of an upgrade than the lack of a change of appearance would indicate.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice, although I think that was intentional on Apple to make you feel okay if you have an iPhone 4, right?
Yeah, well, no, not just that, but I mean, isn't it silly to think that Apple would come up with a design as radical as the design for the iPhone 4 and then say, no, God, that's so 2010, that's so dated. When you design something that has really no features like this and it's as simple and classic as possible, the whole point of that design is to make sure that you could be using this phone 5 years later. And
you know that the iPhone 5 will not look this way, or will it?
Well, I don't know. It didn't take very long for everybody to start backpedaling on
all those.
Yes, all of my iPhone 5 predictions were absolutely spot on. I assure you, it's just that, and this was a direct quote from somebody that I don't want to name him, but he was saying, my sources tell me that when Steve Jobs knew that the end was coming, he decided that he was going to put all of his passion into the iPhone 5, and that the iPhone 4S was a shabby little attempt at an iPhone. That was fine. As long as he put his passions into the iPhone 5. All the wonderful features that I promised you were going to be having were going to be in the iPhone 5.
I saw that story, too, and I thought that was reprehensible. Actually.
Yeah, I thought that's just dumbass.
Using Steve Jobs' name to justify your bad lead or your bad tip. It's reprehensible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've done this before, and I've heard a rumor and had enough data behind it that I thought it was valuable for someone to hear. I was so tentative about saying this sort of stuff. And I did, and once or twice I've been wrong. But if that happens, that's life in the NFL. You got to say, okay, I wasn't just being irresponsible. I thought I had it right, but I didn't. Oh, well.
Well, and my experience of talking to anyone that might be down in one infinite loop is that when Steve Jobs was there, he pretty much paid attention to everything.
Yeah, including the T-shirt design the leather in the company van.
Everything. So
it was really kind of stunning to see that article, though. I mean, to just see somebody double down, like what, three days later? It's like, I don't know. Yeah. I'm totally
we were right.
About this.
We're still right.
You just wait.
Well,
come back in a year.
And I know this is hopeless, but can we now please just remember these rumors are worthless? They're worth them. You know the toilet paper they're written on? I mean, it's just...
Of course we can't. 3 days later, Leo.
I know, immediately.
We're talking about it. Here we are.
Immediately. It's incredible. All right, well... You know what? I'm glad they didn't change the case because all my accessories still work.
Well, that's I think that was one of the big features of it not changing is that I have so many cases and I have so many little chargers and all kinds of things for my iPhone that it was going to be – I was a little bit – I was bracing for impact for a new iPhone 5 that I was going to get and then now I have to get a whole bunch of new cases. And so I was kind of glad.
Yeah. So, gosh, there's so many things to talk about. I don't want to kind of lump them all in one big bunch. So, let's start with, golly, I mean, a lot has happened since I was here last. Let's start with the iPhone 4S sales. The 4 million, Apple announced 4 million iPhone 4S's sold in the first weekend, not only eclipsing previous iPhone sales, eclipsing all previous smartphone sales, not only eclipsing all previous smartphone sales, possibly the fastest selling consumer electronics device of all time. Why?
I mean, not bad for a minor upgrade.
Weren't we a little weren't we a little disappointed by what was in this? Yeah, we thought it was a minor upgrade. I guess we were wrong.
Well, is that the pre-orders as well as the new sales? So that's the so there was 3 million pre-orders, I think, wasn't there in the first weekend?
Right.
So then another million bought them.
Well, it doesn't. You know, I mean, the point is that they count it the same way they always have.
Right.
It's the most sales ever. That people went to stores and or got in the mail their iPhone 4S's 4 million of them. Partly Sprint, right? Pent-up demand at Verizon, right?
I think with smartphone sales, there's so many factors that come into play because it really isn't it's not like an iPod where you can sort of buy one whenever you want. This might have been a perfect storm sort of event where not only were the features there, not only was it a good presentation, but also just a lot of people were in a position where they were able to buy a new phone at this time. And I think that a lot of people were also sort of aiming themselves towards 2011 as the year that they were going to finally ditch whatever they had existing, whether it was a 3GS, whether it was an Android phone, whether it was even just a basic feature phone, and finally get into iPhone. So there's a lot of factors here. The fact that there was 4 million units in no time whatsoever, that's a little bit too many for me to simply think that Siri and a brand new camera was enough to get people to say, yes, now there's finally voice interaction. That's what I was waiting for the iPhone. I've got to have this phone.
I also think it's probable that there were a lot of 3GS and 3G users who finally upgraded, who hadn't upgraded to 4 for whatever reason. Maybe they listened to Consumer Reports. Well, I don't know.
They were fairly informal surveys, but I think you had Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster and somebody else. Maybe UBS analyst Maynard Amin, I can't remember, talking to people online, and what they were saying was that it was somewhere between 75% and 77% of the people that they talked to were upgrading.
Aha!
So I mean, a lot of people were
upgrading from iPhone 4.
Well, it didn't say. I mean, that's the problem. I don't understand. If you're going to stand around in line, why don't you ask some really important questions? Like, they didn't talk about how many people were going from Android to iPhone. They talked about device makers, generally speaking. Right. So they know that it was this many people going from LG to the iPhone or this many people going from Motorola to the iPhone. And so you can sort of say some of those are going to be Android upgraders, but a lot of them are just going to be people who are going from, dumb phone or flip phones. I'm actually really curious to see what they say about iPhone sales on tonight's earnings call, because the weird thing to me is, I mean, we all talk tech, right? There are so many people who just didn't even seem to realize that we hadn't gotten a new iPhone over the summer and that we were about to get a new iPhone. People were just still going to Apple stores and buying phones. So, I mean, I'm wondering if even going into what we thought was going to be an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 4S or an iPhone Supra or whatever we thought it was going to be called, I'm wondering if even going into that, we still saw a record number of iPhone sales last quarter.
Yeah, I bet we
did. Seems like it could happen.
I bet we did.
Like, I just sit there and just go, text Doug, and then I go, okay.
But I like it better if you say tell Doug. It's just imperative. Tell Doug works. I just love just saying tell Alex I'm going to be late. I just love doing that.
Yeah.
And it says, okay.
Well, and the one of the things that's a little known, it definitely feels like Dragon. So if you've used Dragon software, you can put all your punctuation in as well. So
can you say period, question mark.
You can say period, question mark, comma, quotes.
Can you say bang, hash bang?
I don't know. I haven't tried that
before. I have to try that.
But I've done like open parenthesis, close parenthesis. Like all of that stuff can be, put in. It is easier, I have to say, to input like text messages if you use the
when you open up the keyboard and use the little yes. microphone. Because I have to admit, when you say, when you tell Siri, I want to text somebody, she cuts you off so fast. Like if you right. have to think for a second about what you want to say, she immediately that's, just goes, okay, that's enough.
One thing Apple does very differently from Android. Now, admittedly, Android has these voice commands and voice actions, and I have used them. I'm one of the few because I always tell people, use them. They're great because mm-hmm. I love them. I do believe the recognition is better, but that's one significant difference. Siri will, if you use the keyboard microphone, will patiently wait for you to say, I'm done.
Right.
And can go on and on and on. And Android will not do that. Android will stop as soon as you pause, often inopportunely.
Well, and the other thing is that if you have Pages on your iPhone, you can sit there and just hit it and then just dictate an entire, you know, I mean, you can just keep on dictating like you would with Dragon. And then when you look at the iCloud, then you can have it available on yeah. something else to clean it up and do anything else you want with it.
It's pretty, you know, it's one of those things where we talk about, and I know Andy especially talks about a lot, the subtle fit and finish. He's talking to Siri right now. The subtle fit and finish. I saw you do that.
No, I was, go ahead.
The subtle fit and finish that Apple adds to something is enough to me to put me over the top in using this. I used it on Android. I still use it on Android. It's just a little bit, but just enough a little yeah. bit better
it's
that I use. I
also, really it's just it well. It's really some basic things. I'm still shocked that that Android speech synthesis is so awful. It's Siri will say, I've scheduled you an appointment for 2 p.m. Tuesday to have lunch with Leo. And Android is still...
Well, there is one thing that Android has that Siri does not have. You can change the voices on Android, and you can put better voices on Android.
Yeah, but why would you ship it with a piece of crap?
Well,
I'm sorry.
To save space, way, but, probably I would be on my guess, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, whatever.
No, I think that's phone specific, by the way, manufacturer specific. But SVox is a tool that you can add and will allow you to add other voices. This is the other side of the equation. As long as I'm going to be fair, yes, fit and finish is better on Apple, but it's much more restrictive. You can't, you know, you're stuck with the voice they give you.
But I think
you
can't
change it to the British voice. Apparently, though, if you change it to the foreign language voices, it doesn't do as well or as much.
Right.
It's very interesting.
Well, I think that by staying focused on one thing
right,
rather than making it available, it's easier to make it more stable. It's easier to make it more stable.
They're probably concomitant features.
Also, this is one of the reasons why they're calling it a beta. One of the things that is explicitly on their to-do list is to expand it, the international reach and the international compatibility of Siri. So if there's a reason why Apple has done this kind of unprecedented thing, you think of the last time that I think the last time they actually released a beta into the public was the first public beta of OS 10 at 10.0. So the idea that they're saying, we got something really cool. We think that it's useful as it exists right now, but we can't figure out how people are going to want to use it until lots of people start using it. So if for the first 6 months, it spends a lot of time saying, I don't know what you mean by do these pants make my butt look big? Would you like me to search on the web for it now? Then that's the sort of thing that's going to be the first 3 or 4 months.
Oh, I mean, there's so much. New voices, SDKs. You know, they should know other apps should be able to work with Siri and vice versa. But I do believe that all of this will be fixed once they come out of beta. I can't remember Apple doing a public beta on a product like this before. You know,
it's more like I don't want anyone to overhear me saying, Lord Anatko, master of all he surveys, creator of worlds, destroyer of all.
There's the negative. And you can see what it does on your contact card on the iPhone. It actually puts in quotes below your name the name you've chosen. And so you right. see it says Leo Laporte, quote, gorgeous, quote. So I'm going to
be referred to
that.
By my Klingon name.
If you had an iPhone 4S, Ken, what would you have Siri call you?
I don't know. I'm sort of stumped now. probably some kind of. It'd probably be some kind of superhero. Either that or reach back to mythology. I don't know which. Not Zeus. What was Zeus's dad?
Zeus's dad, Thor. I don't know.
No,
Odin.
That's a whole different
galaxy.
That's a different mythology.
Did Zeus have a dad? I thought he was the father of all things.
Well, no, there were. Weren't the Titans?
Wait a minute.
That's why you have clashes of Titans, right?
What am I thinking?
Siri would know that.
Yes. Let's just. Who is Zeus's dad? If you ask it, who's your daddy? It gives you some funny answers. No,
I think it was Cronos actually. I think Cronos was the father of Zeus.
Father of time.
Yeah.
Chat room is faster than Siri. Who is Zeus's dad? It said, I don't know Liz's dad.
I don't know who Liz uses his father is.
Oh, well.
Just think about how powerful Siri would be if it was connected to something like the Mechanical Turk, where there was some sort of algorithm that sort of went through some sort of system, kind of like the poll the audience on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where it goes out on the list of anybody who gets like one penny for every correct answer. It will feedback if it gets like X number of answers that are agreed upon by random people. It figures out that then I bet that is the correct answer to Zeus's dad. But it'll say according to a bunch of random strangers.
This is why an SDK is important. This is why Apple. Well, and it's not traditionally how Apple does things, but I would love it if Apple would open this up so that you could, in fact, have an app. For instance, it would be a Mechanical Turk app, or you could even tell Siri. You can't even launch apps with Siri right now, which is kind of.
I think there's a psychological aspect here that we all know that Siri is an AI. It's just a piece of software. It's a nice feature on a phone, but it really plugs into that part of our brain that recognizes a specific personality and how we trust that one person and how we communicate with that one person.
Right.
And I think this is a case where we really do need a curation so that things that Siri can say back and answers that they can provide are never really variable, that they're consistent and that they're basically being funneled through. Even if it's just one company that decides that we're going to trust these three sources for navigation information, we're going to trust these four sources for movie information or movie showtimes and stuff like that. So I'm not sure if there were a free-for-all API where I'm suddenly getting answers from the novelty Valley Girl speak generator what's the safe cooking temperature for a steak? It says, oh my god, I think it must be like 100 degrees or something. Oh my god,
yeah,
really?
Well, I think that one of the things that Apple has consistently done is do things very slowly. They introduce a new feature and then they're going to let it, you know, stabilize and figure it out. I mean, we didn't have applications on our iPhone when we first got it, you know, other than the ones that Apple gave us. And then they slowly, you know, open that up, and they slowly open these things up in a way that they can control it. And and try to maintain some kind of quality, you know, assurances. And so I think that what we're seeing right now is a very, very, very early version of Siri. You know, and I think this is going to get much, much bigger, much more complex.
Do you love me?
I'm not allowed to.
Well, sometimes Siri doesn't do what you want it to do. So we're going to come back with our final segment from the best of 2011 for MacBreak Weekly. Hope you're enjoying this. Before we get to the final segments, I would like to mention something we've been using lately. It's this. You don't see this very often. A phone, but it's not just any old phone. This is our Ring Central phone. And you know what's amazing? I've been using the Ring Central app on iPhone. They have an Android app as well. And it's cool because I can check all my phone calls, all my messages. Occasionally, almost always, a message comes in that I don't want to handle. I forward it off to Lisa, my business partner, Eileen, my producer. It really is incredible, this phone system. If you want to put a phone system in your business, you don't want a PBX in the basement, you want the complexity, the service contract, and all of that, I want you to take a look at ringcentral.com. Not only is it very affordable, very easy to set up, you just literally plug in the phone and it works, but the features you get that you can't get on a standard PBX are amazing. Fax in your inbox, email messages, the apps, the ability to forward calls from the phone here to my phone here. It's mind-boggling. This is the best way to put a phone in your office. We didn't want to put a traditional phone system in the Twit Brick House, and we're so happy we went with RingCentral. I think you will be too. Find out more at ringcentral.com. And now our final moments from 2011. What are we going to talk about? Oh, this is kind of the sad part. 2011, a big year for Apple News, but also, of course, a very sad year for Apple fans. And we'll take a look at how we found out about Steve Jobs' passing and some of the eulogizing we did. That's coming up next.
To interrupt briefly because we're starting to see some activity on Twitter about Steve Jobs, and I just want to check on this because we don't want to fall for a phony story, but I believe AP is reporting that Steve Jobs has passed away. So we're going to check this real quickly before we go any farther. And of course, there was a rumor, remember, a couple of weeks ago that he had and we will check that and get it as quick as we can. It is across. It's one of those things that's all over Twitter. AP is saying that Steve Jobs has passed away.
But AP have said things that aren't true before. So.
Yeah, so we will absolutely check on this. But it is absolutely all over Twitter right now. That would explain, of course, why Steve Jobs did not make an appearance yesterday. Did you work with Steve, or was it after Steve's era when you went to Apple?
I actually went there just as he came back. As I said, we've been doing these CD-ROM things, and then the internet did for CD-ROMs. And so the company I was working for didn't manage to jump in time, to pivot in time, if you like. The engineering side had been saying, let's work on the web, let's do more web-based stuff. And the business side was like, no, these CD-ROM things are enormously profitable. We make $1 million for doing one of these. We should keep doing those. And that was true up until Christmas 96, and suddenly that wasn't true anymore. And then we was trying to do... The web development, but with the same kind of production model that we had for the CD stuff, which was didn't really have a great fit. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to build the 3D atlas of the web, and we had a prototype that was downloading tiles over the internet.
Yeah, Apple is now confirming this, by the way. Apple is confirming this? Yeah, Steve Jobs. Yeah, please do a breaking news right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Actually, I'm glad you're here, Kevin. I can't imagine anybody better to have here to do a talk about.
That's pretty sad.
It's very sad. He was very young. And, of course, MarketWatch has the story right now.
Wall Street Journal also reporting. Yeah. No details, just the fact that Apple has reported it.
Very sad. How much did you work with Steve at the time?
Not only indirectly. I didn't work with him directly. I saw him... in the early 90s, when he was at Next, we went and pitched the media editing stuff to him there.
Yeah,
that was when I got the sort of full force of the Steve demo in a small room.
Tell me about that. What is that like?
That was we were visiting the developer guy there, talking about video editing, what was possible on the next step, and then Steve walked in with a lawyer he was pitching the next machine to, and then sat down and gave this almost a one-on-one. Full press demo of the Next and what it could do, and how you could have audio and video and full images in your email, how you could revolutionize communication in the company, and how this would change everything. And, it was very much a net-centric vision in like 1991-ish. So it very much he had that insight at that time, and the Next was what the web was built on. So that. That sort of insight early on that networking was the future was definitely a big chunk of that was Steve's vision too.
Contrast that to Microsoft, where they didn't know for another 3 or 4 years that the internet was going to be anything.
They didn't see that coming. And there's a great video of Steve Jobs from the developer conference in 1996-97 where he's doing Q&A with the audience. This is before he'd actually been appointed CEO, I think. This was 97. And he said, I have this idea of things that we could do by connecting the computer to the network, and there are a bunch of products that I really want to build here. And if you listen to that talk, you can actually see the prefiguring of all the things that were built out later.
In 1997.
1997. He always had this long-term view.
Let me play a little bit of that. I think I have it at the 97 closing keynote. I think this is it. This is the Worldwide Developers Conference. I'll skip.
Thank you, and you've changed my life. And I sort of thought about that for a while. I thought, that's really rude. And it probably happens to him all the time, and I don't want to be like that. So I didn't do it. And in a way, I'm kind of glad that I hesitated, because it gives me an opportunity to thank him this morning in a public setting among people who probably understand that better than anyone else on the planet. So it's a special pleasure this morning to introduce and thank a person who has changed so many of our lives, Steve Jobs.
This is from the 1997 WWDC. Jobs had just come back.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That's interesting.
Good morning.
Thank you very much.
And there's a lot of developers happy to get Steve back, I'll tell you that.
People are mourning there also, right here in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., at the Apple Store. People all over the world are mourning the loss of Steve Jobs. Leo Laporte is the host of the nationally syndicated Tech Guy radio show on Premier Radio Networks. He's the founder of his own internet-based technology network, This Week in Tech. He's interviewed Steve Jobs many times. Leo, what goes through your mind on this sad day?
You know, we were so prepared for this. We knew it was coming, and yet it's still such a shock, and it's so sad. And I'm really trying to focus on celebrating his life. This is a guy who lived his life exactly as he wanted to. Woz said that Steve exceeded every goal he ever set for himself. He's a guy who lived his dreams and changed our lives as a result.
What made him so amazing? Was it his education? Was it his family? Was it his background growing up in California? There must have been some spark there that created this genius.
What are the ingredients that make somebody like that? You know, he was a college dropout. It wasn't his education. I think there was something inside him that drove him to exceed. He didn't care what other people thought. He cared about making great stuff, and he succeeded every step of the way. He stumbled, occasionally made mistakes. He wandered in the wilderness after being fired at Apple, and yet he kept coming back, and I think it was his extraordinary drive that really made him the man he is or was.
So in your interviews with him, what was he like as a person? Was he easy to get along with? Did he like to chat? Did he talk about sports or baseball or something,
oh, no.
Or was he simply focused on technology?
Steve was very focused. There's a famous story about him coming into a conference room and somebody starting to chat about the weekend and him saying, can we raise the tone of conversation here? He was a get-to-work guy. When Steve walked in the room, it was really apparent immediately that he knew he was the smartest guy in the room. Usually, he was absolutely right. He was down to earth. And later, in the last few years, he really didn't do very many interviews. He didn't trust the press. He didn't like the press. He wanted to control the image of Apple and his own image. He was a control freak in every sense of the word. And yet, he inspired us all. I mean, without Steve Jobs, you wonder, where's the excitement going to come from in this industry?
That's a good question, and I don't think anyone really appreciates that. Leo, thanks very much. Aaron Burnett is still with us as well.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is I think everyone seems to be talking about this. Why are we so sad about this? Because I know that I have been. For some reason, I've been listening to American Pie by Don McLean for the last week. And just feeling really, you know, it's just like this, it really does feel like the end of something, you know, and it's kind of hard for me to put my finger on. Andy, why do so many people don't know him feel so sad with the passing of Steve?
I think that anything that ties so deeply into your childhood will have a really powerful mojo on you until the day you die. Whether it's a style of car, whether it's a movie, a piece of music, even a computer. And when you have someone like Steve Jobs, who's in that very, very short list of geeks who, even back in the 80s, were famous geeks, people who you sort of imagine as not as a surrogate father, but at least as, well, here's what you could be like in 10 or 15 years. Yes, you're a nerdy, geeky kid who spends most of your time reading books and most of your time building things as opposed to trying to get a spheroid or oblate spheroid across some sort of chalk mark on some sort of piece of real estate. That's good for you if you like that. But those of us who basically knew what the smell of solder flux and overcooked circuits were when at age 11 thought that, you know what, it would be really cool to be, if we live to be 27, and have the sort of achievements that Steve Jobs has made. So when that sort of element is gone, it sort of reminds you, and this guy who in some way has represented you 10 years from now, he's gone now. And so now there's a certain lack of steering focus, even if it's a very, very tiny one. Again, I don't think anybody rational was pattering their lives against following Steve Jobs and trying, what would Steve do in this situation? But nonetheless, of all the different things, the stars that you navigate by, now one of those is not there anymore. And that's a little bit, takes a bit of getting used to, I think.
I mean, Jason, didn't he seem like he was like the cool kid in school? Like, you know, he was the kid that you were trying to follow. You always wanted to dress like him and be like him.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd go for the he was a geek like us thing. I think he was cooler than that. But, you know, I think this has a lot to do with the products that Steve Jobs helped bring into being with Apple are products that people feel an emotional attachment to. If it's the Mac, you know, people made a choice to use the Mac and to be using a computer that wasn't the PC everybody was using. And more recently, people feel really attached to the iPod and iPhone and iPad. And he was seen as the person who ushered these products into the world. It was his company. You know, we can argue about how much of that is him. There's a lot of myth making. It's not like he was soldering things in his garage and then bringing them out. But the fact is, he was the guy who brought them to us, who introduced them, who got us excited about them. And I think that some aspect of this is it's selfishness in a good way. I think we all feel like the world's a poorer place and without Steve Jobs in it. And we're all a little worried about the fact that, you know, he brought us all this great stuff and now he's gone. So what happens next? And I think that's all understandable. I think, you know, anytime you see somebody who seems like they're so talented and they've created things that have had an impact on your life, even if you didn't know them personally, it's an absolutely natural reaction to look at their passing and say, you know, boy, it's not going to be like it was ever again.
Well, and I think that even though he wasn't writing the code, even though he wasn't soldering the boards together, obviously, you know, what he brought, that clear vision of what makes a difference and what doesn't make a difference and what needs to be removed, made just such a massive impact. Adam, what do you think? Where do you think the tech world would be without him? I mean, what would have happened? You know, I mean, I know it's a big question, but I mean, would we still be using
Steve
like
Jobs?
It feels like we would still be writing, you know, code.
Well, I do think there's a lot to that, and one of the things that we looked into with Tidbits in our special issue last night was just what would have happened if we hadn't had Steve Jobs pushing the personal computer very early on, because you had a bunch of really kind of weird stuff. You had the Commodore, you had the TRS-80, stuff like that. It wasn't.
It's
really
not like he created some of that too. I mean, Xerox had the idea of a graphical interface.
But he's the one who really turned it into something that people wanted, and that made it into a market. And you can't even eliminate the fact that that's in large part why IBM started the Skunk Works project to do the IBM PC. So if you take Steve Jobs out of the picture, I think you're talking a very, very different personal computer world, if in fact you even get one. And, you know, as the guy who, you know, wrote the article pointed out, you know, Tim Berners-Lee, you know, eventually invented the World Wide Web on a Next machine. So, you know, there's a whole, you know, it's one of those, you know, parallel universe things. That what if could be very, very strange without Steve Jobs.
There could be a very good short film there somewhere, you know, the world without Steve Jobs. And just it's very...
Damn it. Sometimes I wish that Steve Jobs had never been born. In the
no, it's like
Steve Jobs, come back.
Yeah, it's like It's a Wonderful Life without, you know.
I was thinking more like those educational films where they say, if we took away zinc oxide.
Now, Andy, how long do you think Apple can continue his trajectory, like in the same vein? Or do you think they're going to start pivoting quickly? Is it going to be something that trajectory is just going to continue to go out for some period of time?
Well, I think everybody pretty much knows that the strategy has been mapped out for a few years in advance, at least. So it's not as though Apple's the least reactive company in the world. They just keep looking 4 or 5 years out. But I really hope that they are no longer following Steve Jobs's map or template 3 years from now, because remember that he himself was looking 4 or 5 years in the future. And now he has stopped looking into the future because he can't really see what's coming in his current state, unfortunately. So I would like to think that by having a set of a roadmap for how to think and how to plan and how to run the company, and also a roadmap for what the company is by its very nature, we'll start to see some shifts in the next couple of years when a new opportunity arrives for, be it a new manufacturing process or a new way of moving data from point A to point B, or even just a new basic shift of noticing that the people in Starbucks who used to be using an iPad and an iPhone next to them are now using an iPhone and a laptop next to them. What does that tell us about how people are using computers these days? And it's those things, from the large scale stuff to the simple things of just noticing how people are holding a certain phone, that will really shape Apple's destiny and eventually have much more of an impact than any plans that Steve might have made.
Well, I mean, and Jason, is it how necessary is it for Apple to change the direction right now? I mean, the question is they've built a new industry, and it's now expanding very, very quickly. I mean, I think we just saw the news this week that 97% of all tablet traffic is the iPad. Is it something that for at least the short next 2 or 3 years, they almost just have to not screw up? It's kind of like one of those things where your football team is winning by 24 points in the end of the third quarter. They just have to not throw any interceptions.
Right. Well, I think that there's an aspect to that, right, of running out the clock, of saying, how do we maximize the growth? How do we deal with the growth and expansion of our products that are ascendant? How do we deal with the products that are kind of coming down the other side? But if that's all you do, then you're, you might win the game, but you'll lose, you won't even make the playoffs because, to extend this metaphor way beyond its due. But yeah, I think the key for Apple is to use the Steve Jobs playbook in terms of how do we do what we do? How do we find new products? How do we make judgments? How does everybody here make decisions about what's next? What they need to not do is sort of slavishly say, well, Steve liked this thing, so let's do that because Steve liked it. Because to Andy's point, the fact is Steve's not around anymore. He's gone. He can't make those judgments. You know, Steve Jobs wouldn't sit there and say, I pretty much believe what I believed 5 years ago, so let's just keep doing that. He would continue to adapt. So if they've done their jobs right, everybody's going to think, we're going to adapt like Steve. We're going to always question where things are going like Steve. And if they can do that, they're in much better shape. I mean, they've had, 8 years of knowing that their leader had a pretty serious form of cancer and has spent, especially the last 4 years, he's been very sick. Apple has gotten itself pretty well prepared for this period in its life, better than most companies, I think, do. Whether they'll succeed or not, I don't know. But for me, it's, you got to go with the playbook, and that means always questioning, always asking those questions and being really critical about products like Steve would do, not just say, what did Steve like when he was here?
Well, and we also see that. We see that culture in Pixar, where the questioning is really what makes a lot of what Pixar movies great, that everything is up for grabs. Everything is constantly being attacked. Mm-hmm. Everything is, it's a cult, this intense cauldron of creativity that's going on there. So hopefully we'll see that. Now, Adam, Tim Cook is taking over. We saw a much different keynote than we've seen in the past, where he's not doing a lot of the stuff himself. He's handing that off. How else do you see Apple changing under his leadership?
Well, again, in the near term, not a whole lot, because Cook has really been in charge in a lot of ways for, frankly, quite a few years. I mean, as COO, he's been in charge of the day-to-day. And certainly as interim CEO, whenever Steve took a medical leave of absence, or when he actually stepped down, as a CEO in June, Cook has been able to, as far as we can tell, just continue along the same game. So I'm not seeing a whole lot changing. Honestly, I don't know Tim Cook very well. He's been one of those people sort of behind the scenes at Apple who has, they've just always gotten the job done quietly. And so I don't really know if he has a particular style that will become obvious over time that's radically different in terms of how the company will be run.
Do you think it's going to be a little less stressful working at Apple? I mean, I know there's a lot of stories about there was a story in one of the things we were looking at photographers, being used to being yelled at by
Definitely
Steve.
Definitely not. There's already one Tim Cook story, which is they were talking about a problem on the production line in China, and he had this guy there who was working on it that they were talking this about, and then like 2 minutes later they're continuing to talk, and Tim Cook looks at the guy and says, "Why are you still here? Go to China now." And the guy didn't pack anything, drove to SFO, got on a plane, the next plane to China. He had nothing planned. So Tim Cook is an intense guy. He's a really operations focused guy, hence the go to China and see what the heck is going on over there. But right. He's an intense guy, and I know that all the reports say that he and Jobs, one of the things that they really connected, where Jobs interviewed him and was like, "This is the guy. This guy is great." He is intense. He's got different skills and different interests, but he's got that. So I think Apple is going to be similarly managed in that way. Yeah, why are you still here?
Yeah. Yes. So I think that it'll be really interesting to see. It seems like we won't really know until we see another large product launch. Until we see something significant that isn't just a continuation. And it's hard to say, what that next thing will be. I'm still holding out hope for a TV. I want a whole TV. I don't want.
Oh, come
just,
on, go all the way to a car. I mean, we want
yeah,
to
well,
car.
You know, if Apple made a car, how many people here would buy an Apple
I'd buy
car?
It.
I'd buy a car. You know, it'd be electric right, and it'd be round, and you'd be able to use Siri in it, and you'd just be going, "Car, take me to San Francisco," and you know, and it would just drive you there. You know, it's so. Yeah, it's like,
okay, I end up buying all the copies, so I have two copies of the hardcover from Amazon. I have iBooks version, which is quite nice, by the way. It's the first book I've really read on iBook. I thought I should read it on the iPad, right? I got the Kindle version, which seems so barren, especially because there's lots of pictures in it. And then the audiobook version is quite good. Although, if you want to get through something fast, audio is probably not the way to do it. Andy, have you finished the book?
I'm only about a quarter of the way through it.
Yeah, I'm about a third of the way.
And part of it is just being slowed down by all the really great bits inside it. I mean, it really was a very open interview. If you think it's a very, very open book. And when you don't get about 4 or 5 pages in before you start to see a lot of the real truth behind it. There really is no myth making here. It's all about making sure you understand exactly who Steve Jobs was, good and bad, and very bad sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Leander, did you have an advanced copy? Were you able to read it before we got it?
I got it on Amazon the night before. So they sent me a copy and it showed up here first thing yesterday morning.
Right.
But I managed to get it through Kindle on Sunday night and I started reading it on my iPad in bed. And it's a remarkable achievement, but it's not
engrossing.
A fun read.
It's not a fun read?
I didn't think so. No, I thought it was, you know, I became quite depressed yesterday, really.
What I did too, and I'm just curious what depressed you about this.
Well, he was such a difficult man.
Yeah.
He was such a taskmaster, and it really is just sort of a catalog of very bad behavior.
Yeah. although you can't gainsay the results.
Right.
I'm up to through the Pixar part. But what struck me in the part I've read so far was the Mac team. Now, most of the stuff up to this point we know pretty well. There's no real revelations, or not any major ones anyway, in the first third of the book. But you still really – I was struck by the fact that the Mac wouldn't exist without Steve just relentlessly dogging that team.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Johnny Ives said, and he had a great tribute to Jobs at the Celebrating Steve's event at Apple last week. And he said, you know, that we all paid a price for these products, but Steve paid the highest price. You know, he cared the most. And that clearly comes through here. I mean, it's an enormous effort on his part. I mean, huge drive. And I don't know if it really illuminates it, really, though. You know, I don't know if I really understood what pushed him so hard.
Yeah, there's a lot of pseudo-psychology at the beginning saying because Steve was abandoned by his birth parents, that wound never healed, that he, in fact, abandoned Lisa, his first daughter, at the same age that his father had abandoned him, 23, and that he was always looking for a father figure, hence Arthur Rock and John Scully, and, you know, a succession of... father figures.
That's
pop psychology. I don't know if you can. And Jobs himself denied it. He says, you know, that's overblown.
I mean, a lot of psychologists say, you know, if you want a person to be successful, oftentimes removing the father figure early is regardless of whether they
that gives them some drive, huh?
Because they're basically running up against something they can't compare.
So well in the inner city.
Yeah, so the I mean, there's a lot of other components to that, but there's a lot of people. There's a that when they can't compare themselves to someone, you know, they just keep on driving.
And yet, you know, his adopted father, Paul Jobs, was very influential. Clearly,
well, you can see the kind of stuff in the book when they're talking about him
perfectionism,
teaching him to make the back of the fence as beautiful as the front of the fence, even though no one's going to see it. You can see early on you start adding that level.
Although,
of detail.
I got to say, going a little far, there's two anecdotes in here about painting the machinery, and both the Macintosh and the Next Cube factory were fully automated, and Jobs insisted and spent hours agonizing over the colors that the machinery should be painted. Finally said, I want white walls. Debbie Coleman, who was running the Macintosh factory, said, you can't have white walls in a white museum, white walls in a factory. He said, yes, you can, and we're going to. And they painted the walls white. He brought his dad in. He would go in with gloves, military style, and inspect for dust. He proudly brought his dad in to see all the machines. There's one machine that he didn't like the shade of blue it was painted, one of the robots that built the Mac. So he painted it blue against all the engineers' advice. You can't repaint it once it started. It never worked right. They named it Steve's Folly. And not far from learning from that, he did the same thing with the Next Factory. Of course, the Next Factory wasn't so critical because it was built to make 10,000 Next Cubes a month and only had to make 400 a month. So they really only had it on one day a month. He was obsessive about details that probably he didn't need to obsess about. You know, I mean, it's not just the back of the fence.
But I think that it's always the whole picture. Being obsessive about details doesn't mean you're always right about those details. It's just but that obsessiveness is also what got us these computers and this
iPhone.
Well,
I agree.
And so it's spread out over everything, and sometimes most of the time it looks like it hit pretty well, and definitely there are a lot of examples in here where it didn't. But I think it's a state of mind that is hard to turn off.
Right, and luckily he had a great team to bounce ideas off, because it's clear that the people around him, the people that he chose to work with, were so important to keeping his wacko ideas in check. And I think he had as many wacko ideas as he had good ideas. I mean, he obviously had great instincts, but you know, he would suggest some crazy stuff. You know, the robot being a good example, and you know, they would debate stuff a lot. You know, I thought it was interesting about while they were trying to, the iPod was taken off, but it never really took off until they took it to Windows. And this is something that he, you know, sort of fought to his dying day. They fought about this for 6 months. Every week, you know, meeting after meeting, fighting. And in the end, he was, you know, he just said, okay, you assholes go and do what you want. And
in the long run, it seems from this book that, and the Mac team is the one where it really seems to have worked, at least so far. I haven't gotten to the later years, but, you know, he hasn't returned to Apple yet. But the Mac team is an example of where he would, if you fought back, he would respect you. And it was his position. I think this is not such an incorrect position, that if you want to make a good team, you can't have B and C quality players. A players want to work with A players. And he said, oh, I'm chasing, by being such a jerk, I'm chasing off the B and C
players. Let's not give him that much credit, because, again, I too am a member of the Haven't Made It All Through the Book Club, but you get the impression that I've met people like that who use that as a legitimate tactic, saying that, look, if you're not willing to fight for your position, you must not believe it very strongly anyway, and so you're just not of much use to it. So I believe that there was from that, and also stories I've been told by people who like work with Steve a lot, that there was that component to it. But a lot of it was just that he just didn't care about your feelings. He just didn't. There are really good managers who have a way of saying, well, we're obviously not on the same page. This may not be the sort of company where we can work together to your fullest, and maybe we should start looking at things like that. He'd be like, okay, you're an idiot. You're an ass. Why are you doing here? Why are you wasting everybody's time? That was totally unnecessary.
You know, the other thing that struck me in this book is there's a lot of tears. Steve cries at the drop of a hat in this book. And not only Steve, but it's John Scully bursts into tears at one point. People are crying a lot in this book.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the talk about what Andy was talking about. I think one of the complicated things to do great things is that you have to have people do things that are bigger than themselves, that are more than what they were going to do without you being there. And I think that there's this crazy balancing act between having the empathy to understand where they're coming from and where they are, you know, as far as they haven't slept for 4 days or whatever, and also having the lack of empathy to be committed to, you know, completing a mission.
Well, here's an example. They talk about in the book, Andy Hertzfeld and all the Mac team, in order to get the Mac software working for the demo, you know, the one where he says he comes out of the... Actually, it was before the demo. It was for ship day. They had to stay up 3 nights straight. Burrell Smith or one of them brought a big bag of espresso coffee beans, and they were eating chocolate espresso coffee beans for 3 days straight. They're done. Hertzfeld's like on the couch, comatose. Goes home. They all come back a few hours later. They plan to spend, you know, sleep forever, but they come back a few days later to see how the thing's doing. Jobs says, oh, by the way, I need a really cool demo. That's the one where they write, hello, I'm Macintosh. It's good to get out of the bag. They had to write that demo. So they go, okay. So finally, Hertzfeld, it's done. He takes a leave of absence. Jobs distributes stock options at that point and doesn't give Hertzfeld any. And Andy comes in and says, well, what the hell? He says, well, and the people on he actually asks his boss, not Steve, well, what the hell? Boss says, oh, well, nobody who was on leave got options. He says, well, wait a minute. I wasn't on leave. I'm exhausted. I wasn't on leave. I mean, he had to fight for it wasn't an option. It was $50,000 a bonus. He had to fight for his $50,000 bonus. He finally got it. But that's the kind of thing Jobs would do. He would push people to the edge of exhaustion and past it and then move on. It's like, okay, what have you done for me lately?
Well, there's a really cool line from one of his first girlfriends who said, he was an enlightened being who was cruel. That's a really strange combination.
Yes. Leander, you got to talk to Walter Isaacson. He interviewed you for the book because you're quoted in it, right?
Yeah, he took a quote from a book, and he listed Inside Steve's Brain in the bibliography. So he looked at that. He sent me a really nice note saying that he'd read the books and looked at the website, and they were all really useful.
Isaacson did his homework here. He's former editor of Time magazine, and he knows what he's doing. He's written several very good biographies, including the Einstein, which is excellent. So when you talked to him yesterday or the day before?
Yesterday, while he was trying to get some lunch and check out of his hotel, he's on a media tour in New York.
Yeah, I bet.
So we squeezed in a 20-25 minute phone call. While he was clearly a bit punchy because his blood sugar was low.
Poor guy.
He's been doing the 60 Minutes interview had aired just the night before, and he's busy like crazy this week.
So what did you glean from your conversation yesterday?
He went into a little more detail about Jobs. The big thing from 60 Minutes was that Jobs delayed his cancer treatment. He delayed getting it removed anyway for 9 months. And of course, this may have cost him his life. And he instead was looking at alternative treatments. He didn't want his body to be violated. Didn't want to be opened up and have part of his pancreas removed.
So he tried herbal remedies and dietary remedies and a bunch of quack
stuff.
Even
a psychic, apparently. Yeah.
That may have killed him. Because, in fact, many doctors think that 9 months was enough for it to metastasize, and it would have been treatable had he gotten operated on right away.
Yeah, that looks to be the case. No one wants to say no. No one can know for sure, of course,
right.
Because it might have spread already before. But they advised him to get it out straight away. And of course, his wife, Andy Grove, who was a good friend of Jobs and a cancer survivor, advised him to do that. Larry Ellison told him to go do it. You know, everybody basically was saying, get it out. And I asked Isaacson, how could somebody who's so rational, make such an irrational decision and such a unscientific decision? Here's a guy who's one of the leading technologists. Why wouldn't he have a modern scientific-based treatment? Well, Isaacson said that he was, a lot more active in all of his in exploring all of the different alternatives. Obviously, he was reluctant to get operated on, but
I think it actually shows it. And Isaacson talks a lot about this, that Jobs trusted intuition more than rationality. Again and again, it says in this book, it was about intuition for him. That's what he learned when he was in India for a year. That's what he learned in his Zen studies. He really trusted his intuition, his gut. And that's where he'd do code reviews. The person who put the code on the table, he wouldn't even pick it up. Of course, Steve wasn't a coder, as Bill Gates points out. Kind of bitterly, but he wouldn't even pick it up. He'd say, "That's crap. Make it better."
Right,
and so he trusted this gut, and this in this case his gut failed him. I think.
Well, one thing I will say is that we don't know what would have happened. Like his gut told him not
to
do it.
We have no idea.
His gut told him not to do it. We don't know what would have happened. Of course, doctors can tell us that everything would have been fine if they had just done the operation. But my great grandfather died from a routine tonsillectomy.
Right.
It could have been something.
Although this particular kind of cancer is highly, apparently, I'm not an expert, highly operable, and it's a shame. I feel bad. It's interesting. The other thing that comes through several times in the book is that Jobs was fairly fatalistic. He said he would die young. He told Scully, I'm going to die young. I need to do a lot right now. I need to accomplish a lot right now because I'm not going to have many chances. So this might have been almost self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it certainly was. He was obsessed with death. He was going on about it in his 20s that he thought he was going to die before he was 30. He told Scully that he thought he was going to die before he was 30. And yeah, that obviously drove him a lot. We were talking earlier about what drove him, and I think that fear of death definitely pushed him to try to make a mark. But Yeah, and of course, you know, he died just right, sort of at the height of his powers. I mean, I think that's why we saw that huge. A lot of shock. There was a lot of shock, you know, with all the memorials that showed up at the Apple stores when he died. You know, a lot of people felt that he was just really getting going. He was really just starting to get some respect too. Most of his career, you know, people thought he was just a slick salesman, a marketer, a fast talker. You know, somebody whose reputation was built upon the work of others like Wozniak and Johnny Ive. And it was only, you know, I mean, even up until the iPhone, I would say up until 2006, 2007. People thought he was like a one-hit wonder. The iPod was, you know, Apple getting lucky. The Mac was still had a niche market share. You know, even though Apple was obviously on a firmer footing, he wasn't being lauded in the business mags. He wasn't a CEO to emulate. Everyone sort of criticized his management technique and felt that there wasn't something that anybody else could learn from. So.
Well, in fact, his first go round at Apple, he kind of was a jerk. he did make the Mac. But yeah, I haven't gotten to the second yet. But one of the things they said is it wasn't getting fired. Is it really? Oh, geez. It wasn't getting fired that taught Steve. It was failing with Next. Of course, while he's failing with Next, he's taking this little company called Pixar, trying to convince the folks at Pixar that their business is selling hardware and software. But there's this guy, John Lasseter, who says, well, hey, let me just make some demo films to show off what our software can do. Wins an Academy Award. Steve Jobs funds this, by the way, out of his own pocket because there's no money being made by Pixar at this point. And spends $300,000 on the tin toy.
And by the way, like, the Oscar. I think all of those shorts, all those early Pixar shorts Amazing. Are on iTunes. I have them all on my kid's iPad.
And it started with little Luxo Jr.
There's a lot of early ones that are very rough animations.
And they were just demos of what the Pixar hardware could do.
Well, and it's also, it was John Lasseter testing animation. I mean, of course, that's what he told Steve Jobs. But, of course, Lasseter came from animation. Lasseter's not interested in technology. He's interested in making movies.
After Tintoy, Disney came after him very hard, saying, we want you to make a movie about toys, intelligent toys. And Lasseter was so loyal to Steve at this point. And this is the other side of that coin. Lasseter loved Steve Jobs so much at that point, he said, no, I'm going to stay at Pixar. You know, and eventually what happened is Disney made a deal with Pixar, said, well, you know, let's do some movies. Right. And, well, you know what happened.
You know, since this has come out, there's been actually a little bit of criticism of the book from people like Syracuse, Dave Weiner. I think on balance, though, this is fascinating. There's a lot of information in here. It's not the final biography that will ever be written of Steve Jobs. But I think it's still a great read. If you haven't read it yet, it's certainly well worth reading. This one's on Audible, by the way. Be a good Audible pick for you for that free offer. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's Mac Break Weekly, a best of. We'll be back on Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time, for a brand new year and a brand new Mac Break Weekly. On behalf of Alex Lindsay, Andy Iannocco, and all of our many contributors, Eileen Rivera, our producer, and who edits Mac Break Weekly? Is it Jeff Stewart, our editor? We thank you for watching all year long, for listening all year long. We hope you'll continue to listen, and we'll see you next time. Another Mac Break Weekly is Brooke. Happy New Year.